X-Men style.
Should I call you Logan Weapon X?
No, Wolverine, snickety, snickety, snoring.
What he's doing is imitating Wolverine's berserker attack with his adamantium claws.
Never would have guessed.
All right, guys, you have your mission. Go forth and wreak havoc.
Following program has adult language and potential spoilers. Listener be advised.
Everybody, welcome to the Marvel Superheroes Podcast. I'm Ali Machina. With me is
Diablo Frank
and
Mr. Fix-It.
And today we're going to talk about snicked Wolverine. Did you guys like the sound effects I did?
Yeah.
I actually want to hear the one from the video game where he does, what is it?
Berserker Barrage.
Berserker Barrage.
Yeah.
Berserker Barrage.
Berserker Barrage.
You win.
Huge fan of Wolverine and
video. I'm sure Frank has no idea what we're talking about.
Marvel vs. Capcom, dude. Wolverine's yep. Yeah.
I think I remember. Yeah, that, no, I'm familiar with that.
Okay.
Yeah. That was a big thing back in the day.
Okay, so you guys want to talk about Wolverine?
Created by Roy Thomas, Lynn Wein, and John Romita Sr. He debuted in a Hulk comic from July 2nd, 1974. Have either of you ever read Incredible Hulk number 180 through 181?
I'm telling you I have. For sure I have.
I have.
So what happens?
I think I had like a reprint or something.
Yeah. Well, so what happens in the story, roughly?
The Hulk is, I believe, fighting Wendigo.
Yep.
And Wolverine just kind of pops up in his little yellow kitty cat costume. And I just probably described the cover, nothing more. I don't remember. I don't think the story was that deep.
And you probably, all three of us might have read the same version. They did a reprint of the two issues, I think, in the Baxter format. It was rare to see those higher end formats on the newsstand. But I know not only did I buy that from a newsstand, but I'm pretty sure I bought it from a convenience store in the area of Wizard, you know? I think it was probably closer to like the Pasadena Town Square Mall, but I remember picking that book up and there's this weird sense memory of it being from that area. And it had the wraparound cover. I don't know if they got somebody flashy to do that cover or not, but the interiors were Herb Trimpe and I was never a big fan. And I remember feeling kind of ripped off because the whole first half is just Hulk versus Wendigo. Now, can you tell us who Wendigo is, by the way?
He's kind of like Sasquatch, but he's... like a were-person, or
you're like an albino Sasquatch. He's all white.
Yeah. Well, no. Well, there was already a albino Sasquatch. That's Snowbird.
Yeah, but that was Snowbird taking the form of Sasquatch for a brief period of time. So one of the big things with Wendigo is that's derived from Native American lore, or actually, I think it might be Native Canadian lore. And apparently, the thought was that if you ate human flesh, if you resorted to cannibalism, you could become a Wendigo. You develop a taste for human flesh, and so you have this giant weird beast going out to eat people. So I that aspect I kind of dug, but I just couldn't get into the art, and it was just, you know, these two, you know, a green thing and a white thing smashing up against each other for a full comic book. And then Wolverine shows up and he's mostly smashing into them too, because he's not actually drawing any blood with his big claws, but he's talking a lot more shit than any of the other two, you know, like they're all like Hulk smash, all right, Wendigo, and then Wolverine be like, bub, I'll tear you up, bub, you know, I'm the toughest one around, that kind of bullshit. So it was the Wolverine that I knew, but it wasn't yet the Wolverine that people were fans of, you know.
Yeah.
So what did you guys think of that original costume design?
I think it's always been inferior to the brown and orange costume. And then once we started reading the Tigra cat stuff and realized that costume is just a huge ripoff of the cat's costume.
Well, actually, I think it was the other way around. I think that Wolverine predated the cat and cat ripped him off.
No, I thought that we Googled it and it came to the conclusion that the cat was first.
You're right, because I'm thinking of Hellcat, but the cat did predate Wolverine, so you're right.
The cat, yeah, for sure. Yeah, that was always... Look, I like the yellow... Look, I think all of his costumes look good. Can I just say that? I think Wolverine with the hair always looks good. But definitely the brown and orange is the winner for me.
I always like the patch look.
Well, we can get to that, though. What did you think about the original costume?
The one with the little kitty cat whiskers?
Right.
Nah, not a big fan. I'm partial to the brown and yellow, too.
I mean, I like the stripes, and obviously the basics of Wolverine are already there. So, you know, it's still Wolverine, even with the kitty cat eyes, but he definitely got better, I think. I like virtually every other Wolverine costume more than the original suit.
I just always thought it was weird that his hair was the same size, the same shape as his cowl.
Mm-hmm.
Just always thought that was weird.
Well, and remember, it kept getting bigger and bigger over the years, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it finally peaked, like, I think Kent Williams in the late 80s, where he was going all Bill Sienkiewicz, and it's just, like, fucking flapping in the breeze and shit, and they finally started
raining. Oh, no, I was thinking, like, Sam Keith.
Sam Keith did have a gigantic hairy Wolverine, too. That's true.
Yeah. That, I was going to say, once you guys were done talking, that Sam Keith is the king of Wolverine spiky hair.
Okay, yeah, sneak club. I always think about, also, was it Sienkiewicz that did that Zero Meltdown?
No, that was the Kent Wilson. If I remember correctly, it was Kent Williams. That's the guy I was referencing.
Okay. Okay,
that shit was nuts.
Yeah, that shit was nuts, yeah.
So did you guys ever read any of the 70s X-Men stuff that Wolverine appeared in? Like the earliest stuff that Len Wein was writing before Claremont came on with Cochran?
I don't believe so.
I don't think I
read. Mean, I could have, if it was in a classic X-Men, I probably did. Because I did read quite a bit of classic X-Men issues. But I don't think I went after, like, looking for X-Men comics at that time.
Do you remember what specific stories you remember from reading in classic X-Men? I mean, at least you call it classic X-Men, so that tells
you. Juggernaut was in it. I was going to pick it up. Let's see. Apocalypse is more in the 80s or late 80s.
Well, I'm talking about I thought you were talking about the book Classic X-Men. Are you talking about just Classic X-Men, not the book?
Yeah, the individual issues.
Okay.
The one with the backup stories in the back?
Yeah. Yeah, see, when Classic X-Men started in the late 80s, I picked it up. A lot of us did. A huge impetus for that was the Art Adams covers because, you know, that was one of the only places you could get Art Adams.
I always loved the little stories in the back.
Exactly. The John Bolton backups too. Yeah. So,
great. And then you always got that great page in the back of the book that was just like you could cut it out and put it on your wall.
Mm-hmm. That had to be one of the best-selling reprint books of all time because everybody that I knew of was buying Classic X-Men was coming out. And it was also one of the last ones they put out. Mostly everything started moving to the trade paperback market. So the fact that it lived as long as it did, it ran over 100 issues. People had to have been buying that.
All right, and, quick question. First trade paperback you bought?
Captain America Sentinel of Liberty.
Mine was The Dark Phoenix Saga.
Ah, nice. My brother had that one. The one with the Bill Sienkiewicz cover?
Oh, yeah. The one that has the Phoenix in the back, mm-hmm. on the back cover. It was like a thick trade.
No, yeah. No, another one you meet? Speak up. Mm-hmm. So with Classic with the Classic X-Men, that's where I got my exposure to the Cochran material. And they hadn't really figured out who Wolverine was yet. I mean, for a long time there, they were still thinking that the claws were in the gloves and that his powers were just the enhanced senses. And if you go back to the original stories, you'll see that, what's his name? Thunderbird, the Native American member, pretty much had Wolverine's personality. They killed him off. And then that contrarian personality moved over to Wolverine. But for me, you really don't get the full Wolverine experience until you get John Byrne drawing him. And especially in the midst of the Dark Phoenix Saga, which personally, I've never read the entirety of Dark Phoenix Saga. I assume you did because you had the trade.
Yes, and I enjoyed it quite a bit.
About when do you think you read the trade, though?
It must have been in the late 80s.
Okay.
Because I remember I bought it at, not Barnes & Noble, fuck. It was a bookstore in the mall.
B. Dalton bookseller?
B. Dalton, yes. Because that was the only place besides like your local gas station or Stop and Go that had the books on the little, you know, next to the Playboys and shit. But again, we've discussed where you could never get like back-to-back issues that were kind of random. And that was the only place where they had like maybe two spindles of comics. And then that's where I remember I was allowed to buy like so many comics. And I remember this trade was even, I think I still own it. And I want to say it was like $10 or $11. Maybe even 12, and that was like a shitload of money.
I think a lot of those early trade paperbacks were like $6.95, but for the times,
I just remember it was really expensive, and I had to beg my parents for me to get it.
Think about it. When you're like, talking about
no comics for a month.
Yeah, when you're talking about a comic book with a cover price of somewhere between 50 and 75 cents, and then you're jumping up to $7, that's like almost 10 times as much. That's a pretty damn expensive book.
But I just remember when I got it, I must have read it like cover to cover 3 or 4 times.
And see, with me, my brother always had access to a comic shop when I didn't, and he had more resources, so he could actually pick up some lower grade, real classic X-Men. Like, he had some of the actual Steranko issues, he had some of the Werner Roth stuff. I bet he wishes he'd kept that stuff and kept it in good shape, you know, nowadays. But he also got a hold of some of the Cochran stuff and some of the Byrne stuff, so I actually got to read the floppies of some issues of Dark Phoenix Saga, but not all of them. And obviously, like, I think a big turning point point moment for Wolverine was his fight with the enforcers from the Hellfire Club, where he's really slashing into those guys and he ends up going into the sewer. And you know, you got that great panel that everybody knows.
Yeah, that's where that one guy from Hellfire made him like he intensified his weight or something, or the density of him, and he drops through the floor.
Oh, you're okay. So yeah, but I like the enforcer guys for the Hellfire Club, the ones in the blue with the kind of spiky mask.
Yeah, the goons.
But
yeah, I know.
Then you had the actual Hellfire Club members, and I think you're talking about Sebastian Shaw, who would have
Shaw was the leader. There was another one. It was
the fat guy, Leland.
The portly gentleman who I guess he touched you, and he would intensify the density of whatever he touched.
I want to say,
and Wolverine went through the ground, and that's whenever you see that famous image of him looking up in the dark,
in the sewer with actual shit on him, which is pretty awesome. You had your shot. You took your best shot. Now I'm coming with mine or some shit like that.
Yeah.
I think Leland McCauley or something. Some shit like that was that guy's name. I remember that dude because he's the one who died from the heart attack, right? When Nimrod showed up?
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, the Wolverine that sticks in my mind to this day is the two-issue Brood series.
Mm-hmm. Sylvester.
Where Wolverine is impregnated with the Brood, and so he has like a Brood body with the lips and stuff, but he's, you know, it's Wolverine on the cover. I remember that cover just blew me. I bought like 3 of those issues because I love that cover so much. And then I read the Brood, and the story was even fucking fantastic, except the whole giant shark thing to this day still makes no sense to me.
Everybody I knew who was into X-Men especially loved those 2 covers.
Yes.
I know my brother was a big fan of that one too.
So that, and I remember reading that, and that's really got me, I guess you could say, that's what hooked me to Wolverine, especially the one where he kills that Brood infected human at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that's when I became a Wolverine fan.
Yeah. I was trying to think back to when my first exposure to Wolverine was, and I don't think it was like one of those all at once kind of deals. I think that they had that Dave Cockrum house ad with the X-Men in it, but when they were just starting to get hot, and he was featured in that. I want to say I had one issue of Marvel's Fun and Games. You remember that shit?
No.
That was it was a comic book sized and linked book, but it was full of like puzzles, like crossword puzzles and, you know, mazes and shit that were Marvel themed. And I want to say that Wolverine was in some of those. I also had a friend named Charlie who picked up Avengers on occasion, and he had that one cover, the Avengers 221, that had the checklist where it's like who's going to be the next member, like pick 2 who are going to be the new Avengers. And there's all these headshots with little check marks by them so you could see, pick who you thought would be the next Avenger. That always stuck with me. But I know that the first actual comic book I read with Wolverine was 1983's Uncanny X-Men number 168. That was the Kitty Pryde spotlight, and he only has this tiny little cameo. It's like a couple of pages where he's talking to Nightcrawler. But because, and he wasn't even, his hair I don't even think was exposed. I think he was wearing a cowboy hat. But he had the lamb chops, and he had that surly disposition shit, and it definitely made me interested in this dude. Plus, again, my friend Charlie was picking up X-Men going into the John Romita years, and, you know, seeing the dude with the claws on the cover, you're definitely, it turned, nobody was like that back then. They didn't have anti-heroes like that in the mainstream comic books then, so it definitely got a lot of attention. But I know the specific month that I started becoming a Wolverine fan was January of 1984, because again, rare instance where you had a thick Baxter format comic book on the stands, Phoenix the Untold Story, which was, do you remember what the deal was with that one?
Yeah, that they did the original story where Phoenix comes back, but she's like mentally handicapped or something.
Yeah, basically they did a cosmic lobotomy on Jean Grey.
Yeah.
And so she would still be the Phoenix, but she wouldn't have the mental faculties to access that power. And so she was allowed to live rather than being, you know, executed as was originally intended.
Yeah. I had 2 of those issues in like mint condition. I remember buying them in like bag and boarded, and I've never opened. I've read one, and the other one I never opened because I bought it by accident, I think.
It was so gorgeous. Like, the artwork is so incredible. The Terry Austin's inks on John Byrne with the coloring and on that format, that higher quality format, I'd never seen a comic book that looked that gorgeous. Not even close.
The one that I always, and again, I'm thinking back, the one that I guess got me, because I was always a big Colossus fan. Again, never got into Wolverine. I got into Wolverine slowly, but I was more like Hulk, any of the larger characters. Hulk, of course, Colossus. But I always remember the Follow the Mutants cover, where they're all like laid on the ground dead.
Right, Ellen Day Davis. Yeah, that's a great one, too.
That was a great one. And then, of course, there's, you know, they had all the tie-ins and stuff where they did all the headshots, which I always loved that one. Wasn't there one that was a Wolverine headshot? Because I know I had the Cyclops headshot. I had the Thor headshot. Fuck, I had a bunch of them. I can't remember now.
I'm not sure. Oh, you're talking about the Marvel 25th anniversary ones where they had the border with all the characters and the middle would be the headshots. Yeah, that was a great month. That was a great theme month.
Yeah, that was a great looking book.
And years later, DC ripped it off for, I think they called it Faces of DC, and it was one of the best month of DC covers. For years, I had a Wonder Woman mouse pad that was the Jose Luis Garcia Lopez cover from her issue that month. But when Marvel did it, it was so iconic because they did it for the better part of a year, right?
Like, I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, you got the sense of how big Marvel was because you had that representation of their whole universe in the border, and they would have such great headshots because, again, since you're only drawing ahead, I think the tendency was to put a little something extra into it. And it's just some really iconic images from that time period.
And I'm thinking of there's another cover that always comes, and I know it has to really exist, where it's like Colossus, like the X-Men, and they're kind of lined up, and Wolverine is, I guess, with his claws open, he has a cigar in his mouth, and the cover is like a blue a hue to it.
Yeah, isn't that the prelude to the Mutant Massacre?
Maybe.
Yeah, and it had a great tagline, and I can't remember it anymore, but you know, that was definitely an iconic image too, and very memorable. Of course, we're all, you know, at least you and I, Fix It, are Mutant Massacre babies, you know, like that was like the first crossover, and we were there for it, and you probably bought way more comics that month than ever before.
It was so hard to get all those books, and like I remember feeling like, if I don't have these books, I'm going to miss something in the story.
And see, that was another one too, where my brother, having that comic shop access and having more money than me, he's the guy who could get like the Power Pack issue and shit, you know. So
where Wolverine's in the Power Pack.
Mm-hmm. That was a pretty, you know, especially given that it's Power Pack, you think it's going to be all kiddie and stuff. That was a pretty grim and brutal issue, you know.
Really? I've never read them.
Yeah, I mean, if I remember correctly, I think that's when John Bogdanov was drawing the book, and so it's drawn in a cartoony fashion, so it's not as bad as it could be, but it still has this extended Wolverine Sabretooth fight sequence, and you do have like these children walking around in the Morlock tunnels finding corpses and shit. You know, that was a little, you know, suburban Vietnam they had there.
Fucking the Marauders were the shit, dude.
Yeah, Marauders were the shit. But before we go too deep into the Mutant Massacre, so for me, it was Phoenix Untold Story, and I love that John Byrne seemed to draw every single fucking hair on that guy's body. And I think at that point, when I was a kid, that's what I wanted to grow up to be. I wanted to grow up to be hairy like Wolverine. I wanted to be taller. You know, I wanted to be like Mark Hazard Merc tall or Punisher tall, but I wanted to be hairy like Wolverine, and neither one of those things worked out. But yeah, it was so incredible seeing John Byrne draw essentially the Legion fighting the X-Men. And I thought the Imperial Guard in particular had just gorgeous character designs. It was obviously all the stuff that Dave Cockrum didn't get around to doing on Legion, and the more alien versions of characters that I don't think they would let him do while he was doing Legion. And to see them drawn by John Byrne in his prime with the inks and the colors and everything else, and Wolverine all hairy and badass, it was an incredible introduction to the X-Men, and that's would turn me on to both Wolverine and the X-Men. But also, that was the same month that the last issue of the first volume of Official Handbook of the Marvel Universe came out, number 15. Do you remember which one that was?
No.
That was the Weapons and Paraphernalia issue. So that's the one that had the schematics of the adamantium skeleton and the claws and how they worked and all that shit. So, wow. You know, that was badass. And then also, sometime in 84, the first wave of Secret Wars action figures came out, and you knew it had a Wolverine then, too.
I remember seeing that. Yes, I do.
I know I definitely had a Wolverine, because that was one of the ones that I kept in my stable. A lot of those Secret Wars and Superpowers figures kind of came and went to that time period. But between me and my brother, I think we each had one. So we kept Wolverine around for about as long as we had the G.I. Joe size figures. And I still wasn't buying X-Men, though, for some reason. I think it's because Charlie was buying it, and so I just kind of thumbed through his issues to check it out. And I did buy the first issue of Alpha Flight, and there wasn't a lot of Wolverine in that, unfortunately. It was John Byrne goodness, but I never really gravitated toward them. Alpha Flight is a weird kind of thing, right? Like, do you recall the connection between Wolverine and Alpha Flight and Department H and all that kind of shit?
They're all Canadian.
About it, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's all I remember. There's Puck, there's Snowbird.
But I mean, like, what their deal was. Like,
what was his name? Mm-hmm. There's Talisman. I don't remember the name of the robots.
Box was one of them.
Okay, so what was the name of the other guy? The guy that there was the
Box
the
was the big one. Box was the big one that looked like one of the Micronauts. I don't remember another robot, though.
No, the team leader.
Oh, he wasn't a robot, man. He just just had a cybernetic suit or like a techno suit.
And then the female, it was a female on the team that was like the co-captain.
That was Vindicator. That was okay, his Vindicator, wife.
Snowbird, I want to say Talisman or Tribeman or I can't remember the Native American one that did all the mysticism.
Right. Well, I mean, I didn't want to get so much into Alpha Flight. The main idea is that, you know, Wolverine gets introduced to Incredible Hulk, and it turns out that he was working for the Canadian Secret Service, Department H, and he had been working along, when he was first found in the wilderness, he's this feral creature at that point in time, with no known history, and so he's found by James McDonald Hudson and Heather Hudson, his wife, and they're the ones who kind of nurse him, not so much nurse him, that's not right, but they're the ones who help to reintegrate him into society and begin his life again, and so I think partly in gratitude that he starts working with the Canadian government, and then eventually they're trying to expand to a full super team for the Canadians, but between Professor X showing up and wanting him to take part in the all-new, all-different X-Men's initial mission to save the X-Men, and his government handler trying to tell him what he was and wasn't going to do, that's when Wolverine cut ties with the Canadians, and you had that one story where Guardian goes on to build up Alpha Flight out of these other Canadian superhumans, and they actually go to the United States and try to recapture Wolverine and bring him back to Canada.
Okay.
Did you ever read any of that stuff?
No.
See, that was one of the things that I ended up reading, was that there was an issue of Alpha Flight in the first like year and a half where they actually took the original story from Uncanny X-Men when in the early days of John Byrne doing it, and I think they literally like reproduced panels and shit, because John Byrne was always all about trying to fuck over the publisher and make money, you know, by, I think it's more about the joke of like actually finding clever ways to get paid without having to do the work. You know, he's the one who's infamously got, you know, a snowman and snowbird in the snow in a blizzard, and so everything's white, you know, that kind of shit. But I remember getting more into Wolverine that summer because they had the X-Men Annual Number 8, which was another Kitty Pryde spotlight issue, but it was her telling a science fantasy story, kind of like Star Wars, with Steve Villalobos art, and so I was kind of into that. And then you also had Kitty Pryde and Wolverine, the miniseries starting that same summer. And I've mentioned it, I think, in the past, or maybe I was on one of my other podcasts, the Comic Reader Resume, I had this weird fascination with Al Milgram art back in the day, and I think I was slowly starting to phase out of that at that point. And one of the ways that it manifested was that I, even though I was really into Kitty Pryde, and I knew that the Kitty Pryde and Wolverine miniseries was something I was going to want to buy the first issue of, I just kept not buying it. And then one day it was gone, and there was a number two there instead. And I realized that I'd missed my chance, and I had, like, I guess, kid FOMO. And so I finally bought number two, and I bought 2 through 6. I had the whole rest of the miniseries, and that was somewhat foundational because, again, Kitty Pryde is like my first girlfriend, and then Wolverine is like the badass anti-hero who's unlike any other heroes out there. You have all that cool Japanese stuff, the Orientalism going on, where he's fighting ninjas and he's fighting. Do you remember Ogun?
No.
That's the dude that ran around with the Satan mask, the red mask with the pointy horns.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. I vaguely remember that.
They spent a lot of time there inferring that Wolverine was perhaps centuries old and had been around during the time of the Shogun, and how he was trying to walk the way of the Shogun, which is something they had kind of built into the X-Men for a little while there. And so having him fight this mystical, you know, adversary, and having that adversary like break down and build up Kitty Pryde and his image, and having all the loyalties get divided and everybody's fighting everybody else, and Wolverine, because of the, like, I think he had special poisons where he's actually able to wound Wolverine and make him sick and make him near to death, and he's like hiding in a dumpster covering himself with trash so that Ogun doesn't kill him and shit. That was one of the cool action beats for me as a kid, like one of the first times I'd seen that kind of action in comics, and so it was very foundational for me. But I think the point where I really became full-on hardcore Wolverine fan was 1985's Uncanny X-Men number 193. That was the exercised issue, the 100th issue of the all-new, all-different X-Men, and so they brought back Thunderbird's brother Warpath, who was trying to get revenge for his brother being killed in one of the earliest X-Men adventures, and he brought some of the Hellions from the Xavier School's competing class to help him go after the X-Men. And, you know, it was John Romita Jr., a lot of big action, a lot of pathos. I think that was, by that point, I was definitely full on a Wolverine fan, and he was among my favorite superheroes easily. Plus, you had the Heroes for Hope special come out. They're supposed to aid Ethiopia, and had Art Adams cover where Wolverine's front and center, and then all the X-Men fan out behind him. That was so cool. And I don't know if you remember, but you had the Uncanny X-Men number 207 cover where it's Romita Jr., where Wolverine's literally literally slashing the cover, you know, that you're of the book you're reading. Do you remember that shit?
Yes.
Yeah. So that was another one that was totally iconic. June of 1986 was when Uncanny X-Men number 209 came out. I was steadily buying the book that by that point, and so I was into that. And of course, that led into the Mutant Massacre, that one cover you were talking about. Mm-hmm. That same time, the Incredible Hulk and Wolverine one shot came out. They reprinted the original stories. Classic X-Men got started around then, so I was able to fill in all those gaps from reading that I hadn't done yet. But I think number one is Captain America Annual number 8. And I know Mac knows this one.
Yeah, the Mike Zeck iconic cover.
Been swiped a billion times at this point.
And interiors Mike Zeck did actually, not live up to the exterior.
It was okay. It wasn't as good, but right. It was still Mike Zeck. But it was like Mike Zeck somewhat phoning it in, I would say.
I mean, I just thought the story, you know, you really thought he and Wolverine were going to go knock down, drag out, and it just didn't really happen. I mean, it had like a brief scuffle in it. Of course, this is kind of what happens when two good guys fight a comic book. It's sort of like a misunderstanding and they have a little scuffle and they unite to fight a larger foe. But the cover's so explosive, like you're wanting to see some extreme throwdown, and it just never really happened.
And that one, again, was important to me because I'd always been a Captain America fan, but this was an instance where Captain America shows up and he's talking shit to Wolverine, and I got defensive over Wolverine. I was kind of thinking like, well, who the fuck are you, Captain America? You know, you don't know what Wolverine's been through. How dare you talk to him that way? And that was a moment where my loyalties decisively shifted away from Captain America in that time period onto Wolverine. And Wolverine, I think, was officially my favorite superhero at that point. Plus, X-Men Annual number 10 came out. Fix it, do you remember that shit?
What was it again?
X-Men Annual number 10.
What was the cover?
Mojo.
Oh, yeah. That's where you get, yeah, you get introduced to Longshot and all them.
Yeah. And it was, the X-Babies were in that one too, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah.
They do a whole, isn't that the one where they do like, they go through a varied of different X-Men groups, like the female X-Men, the robot X-Men.
Maybe. Or that might have been one of the later ones. I'm not sure. They definitely introduced the X-Babies in that one. And that was Art Adams, you know, when he was first really blowing up. Because he'd been doing Longshot. And my brother was buying those. And I was reading those. So I knew that Arthur Adams was who he was and what he brought to the table. But when he had a whole annual of that, unfortunately, he'd done the one the year before. But I'd missed that one. It was one of those that disappeared off the stands pretty quickly. I remember seeing it in like a flea market comic shop. But it was sealed up. I couldn't get a look at it. That was the one where Storm became she had Mjolnir for that one issue.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But for me, it seemed like, maybe it's just my personal perspective, but when you had Art Adams drawing Wolverine, that's when suddenly Art Adams was full blown. Oh, this is going to be one of the big iconic artists of all time based on his work. And again, one of those guys who just went in there and drew every fucking hair on Wolverine's body.
You guys want to hear my whatchamacallits to Wolverine and whatnot?
Well, my question is, are we close, timeline wise, are we close to where you come in?
What year are you at right now?
I'm around 86, 87.
You got a few more years. Go ahead.
Let me get there. I remember it was a big deal that you had the Spider-Man versus Wolverine special. Then you get into 1987, and that's when my brother started coming in with his back issues that he was buying, plus Classic X-Men. Then you had X-Men Annual number 11, and Fix, do you remember that one?
Annual 11.
That's
cover.
Where Wolverine basically fights a predator.
No, I don't remember that one.
The great big guy who lives to hunt, and he's like this almost like godlike being, but he's also kind of looks like a predator. And so he's going through the X-Men and he's killing all the members of the X-Men, and he finally gets the Wolverine and he kills Wolverine too.
No, I never read that one.
Drawn by Alan Davis.
No.
Yeah. Again, another classic and another one of those where you see just what a badass Wolverine can be when handled correctly. A classic. I can't believe you missed that one. I'm sorry you did.
I think
at that time I was probably reading What If. That would have been...
The second volume of What If from the 80s had not started yet.
Okay, then, because I'm thinking of Inferno. The Inferno What If.
Yeah, this is before that. Inferno was, I think, 89. Okay,
gotcha.
If he Googles X-Men Annual 11, he'll know. I mean, I remember this issue. What was the issue where they pull his head off and then he like regenerates and shit? What was that one? Do you remember that one?
Not really. I mean, not to spoil it, but they do rip his heart out in that story. And then one drop of blood flies to this crystal that gives him godlike powers. And so he's able to reconstitute himself and then revive the X-Men.
Yeah, that might be it.
Oh yeah, I remember that cover now.
Yeah, where it's like I remember this one too. Where it shows like his brain stem and he's slowly like regrowing and the muscle tissue's going over the bones and then he's Wolverine again. Yep, I definitely remember this one.
Yeah, another classic from the period where he was just hot shit. I also bought an issue of Alpha Flight, which I wasn't prone to doing in that time period, but I bought 53. It had Wolverine on the cover emerging from box we talked about before and drawn by Jim Lee. And while the interiors didn't match the cover, that cover was one of the first instances where where you could see who Jim Lee could become going into the future. And that's good. That relationship is going to be very important going forward. Let's see. But I will say that was also around the time where Wolverine started getting some competition, because that was the year that I moved to Nevada. And one of the last comics I bought before I went, and one of the ones I took with me on the road trip to Nevada, was Superman number 12. The story of him, his relationship with Lori Lamaris. And in that time period, within a few months of getting that book, Superman, as drawn by John Byrne, again, very important, so this is the guy who turned me on to Wolverine. Him doing Superman reminded me of all the things I learned about Superman when I was a younger kid and seeing the movie at the theater and such. And so at least for that summer, for that year, about 87, 88, Superman became my favorite again. But another key comic I bought when I first started going to this school, they had this weird thing. It was a huge school and it was a very affluent school, and I was very poor, so it was a weird situation. But they had this little store where they would sell stuff, and they had a spinner rack with comics. And one of the comic books they had on that rack that I remember specifically buying was Incredible Hulk number 340. And I know Fixit knows this one.
440 cover.
One of the most swiped covers of all time.
Oh, is that the one with Wolverine versus Hulk?
Mm-hmm.
And you can see
Fixit especially.
Yeah, that's McFarlane, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's when he turns into the Gray Hulk. It's gonna be the Wolverine cover with the reflection of the Hulk onto the claws. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and the fact that because Mr. Fixit is more vulnerable in that time period, Wolverine is actually able to cut him and have him bleeding green blood all over the place. It was super violent for the times, and they could only get away with it because it was green blood.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, shit, I think I own probably like 3 copies of it.
Yeah, and that was one of
the... Dude, I'm looking at, I just searched Incredible Hulk number 340. The prices for that comic book are outrageous, dude.
Like what?
Like $250. The signed version, $1,700.
Signed by McFarlane?
CGC 6.5 is listed for $900.
God, 6.5?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Mine is probably better than that. Mine are like bagged and bored, and 2 of them have never been opened.
Now, look, I'm not saying they're selling for this. I'm just telling you what they're listed at.
Yeah.
Like the cheapest one I see is straight up $100.
God, if only I'd known.
Yeah.
I got 3 of them, and I know 2 of them have never been opened. They're bagged and bored.
Yeah, there's a mortgage payment, buddy.
Here's a CGC 9.6 signed by Stan Lee for $2,000. Well, I'm not saying it's selling for that.
Right.
I'm just telling you that it's listening. Anyway.
And I think that's probably the best Wolverine Hulk fight, because again, obviously in the first appearance, they set the standard that Wolverine and Hulk have fights. But I think that's one of the best ones because it was so brutal. And of course, coming out at a time where Wolverine was at his peak and Hulk was being drawn by McFarlane, so he's being resurrected after years of neglect. It's just a monumental image that for people of the Gen X generation who was buying comics at that time period, everybody remembers that story. Everybody remembers the artwork. Everybody remembers the cover and the brutality of it. And it probably is one of the best comic book fights.
Oh, the Ground Zero. I'm thinking about the Ground Zero trade that leads up to it. Was a great.
And so another thing I bought though when I was in Nevada was Punisher number 6, and that started me on to the course of being a Punisher fan. So I'm getting these people that are starting to pull me away from Wolverine, even though I still like him. And then one of the points that really started to turn me was Fall of the Mutants, because I just didn't like it that much. And I didn't like the whole the X-Men in Australia. I know Fixit's a big fan of that, so we're definitely going to be at different points of this. I really started to lose interest in the X-Men at that point. And also, I really didn't like Silvestri's artwork. It just it turned me off. It wasn't what I wanted from my X-Men. And so increasingly, I just wasn't buying the book on a regular basis anymore. So that definitely, Wolverine went from one of my key heroes that was one of my favorites to lower down on the top 10, I would say.
Wow. I love Silvestri's artwork. I actually own a couple pages, so.
Yeah. And then 1988 was also when you started getting the first regular Wolverine solo stories. They launched the bi-weekly Marvel Comics Presents with Claremont, Buscema, and Jansen. And that same creative team started doing the Wolverine ongoing series, which was, I think, $1.75. It was in the Baxter format, so it was a little pricier, but it did get newsstand distribution because it had Wolverine on the cover. And I could never find the first issue. So my first issue was number 2, and I just was not into John Buscema inked by Klaus Jansen. I wasn't into the whole patch thing. I was kind of lost in, you know, why is he in this place called Madripoor and stuff. And so I didn't buy another issue of Wolverine for a long time after that. But were you buying Wolverine off the stand at that point, or is that still a little early for you, Fixit?
When they started his own book?
Yeah.
No, I definitely, I own those issues and I own the trade. I did enjoy the patchworks with a patch. Actually,
explain what patch is. Because a lot of people probably don't know what the fuck you're talking about when you say patch. What is patch?
One of his, I guess, alter egos where he puts a patch over his eye and he's wearing like a ninja suit. But you know it's Wolverine still, kind of. Like, it's one of those Clark Kent things where he puts a patch over his eye and all of a sudden people don't remember it's Wolverine anymore.
Even though he's got that hair?
Yeah. He got the hairstyle and the claws. I remember distinctly picking it up because, number one, the artwork. Number two, Fix-It shows up. And there's that famous, you know, they're both in the white, you know, dinner jackets and shit. And
if I remember correctly, isn't the image that we use as the banner for the Marvel Superheroes podcast blog the cover, that image from that cover?
Probably.
I think
so. It's been a long time since I've seen it. I haven't gone to our, you know me, I'm fucking notorious for not even listening to our own show. So. Yeah.
And so how long did you continue to read Wolverine? Were you just steady for month after month, or did you have...
I kept up with it until about late 20s, early 30s. Mm-hmm. And then I just kind of, I got burned out on it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I just got burned out on it. I wanted to start reading weirder shit. That's when I started getting into the Adam Warlock and shit and Thanos. I think my uncle, who kind of was feeding my comic book habit, because at that time, didn't Infinity War or Infinity Gauntlet come out?
Infinity Gauntlet, not yet. No, we have to get into the 90s. Okay. We're still in the 80s on that. Now, okay, Infinity Gauntlet might have been out around the
Wolverine. I'm reading X-Men. I'm reading Punisher, because I remember they did the Punisher versus Wolverine that everybody fucking lost their shit for.
Yeah. I already was buying the core Punisher book in part.
But that was Jim Lee, right?
Exactly. Jim Lee was the one who was the artist on Punisher War Journal from number one. But in issue 6-7, you had that two-parter with Wolverine that they later called the African Saga. They literally, they did a trade paperback of just those two issues like a month or two after they came out. Yeah.
Yeah, I have that. Same here. And I remember, because I'm a bit of a completist, it took me a while to get that second issue, because it sold out like instantly at the shop I went to. Like, before you would go there, they'd have a few copies so you could get a new copy. And I remember, like, I went, they didn't have it there. I went to Third Planet, they didn't have it there. I went to like another shop, they didn't have it. I'm like, what the fuck? And I could not finish that story because I couldn't find the second issue. And I had to find one of these real, real mom pa comic shops out in the middle of nowhere that had one.
Yeah, I was lucky enough. I had a comic shop in 89 that was built into a grocery store called Marauder Comics. And I was able to pull both those issues off the stand because that was before I had Pull Box. So I definitely remember that. And, you know, Wolverine had never looked, well, I don't want to say never, but that was the most dynamic Wolverine had looked since John Byrne and Terry Austin were doing him. And I although I was already a fan of Jim Lee from the earlier issues of War Journal, he just went to another level starting with that story.
And I have that trade you're talking about, the two-issue trade. I have that trade. I picked it up. I remember at that time, I picked up anything that had Punisher or Wolverine. I think I even had the poster. Like, they had a mini poster. I think I had that at one time.
Mac was trying to get in there. I was just going to give him a space.
I got those issues way after the fact at Cubed. Or was it before that?
No, it was Phoenix Comics before that.
No, it wasn't Phoenix Comics.
Yes, it was.
Troy's.
Yeah, it was a Phoenix Comics.
Troy's?
But the shop before that, it was Phoenix Comics, then it was Cubed, and then they turned... no, it was Troy's. Then they Troy's. Turned it to Cube.
Yeah, so it was Troy's when I went and got these issues for like 99 cents each or something ridiculous like that, because that place was absurd.
Oh, yeah,
and
liquidated everything.
Yeah. Yep. Not being either a Punisher or a Wolverine guy, I kind of have a feeling why you bought that issue.
Yeah, Jim Lee. Yeah, I bought that for Jim Lee.
Did you ever read it?
Yeah, I read them. And it was cool. Yeah, what are they? They're in Africa. I remember Wolverine's got the cheetah skin or whatever on his back, and he's...
Yeah, leopard.
Yeah, there's two great... The one panel where he slashes Frank Castle, and there's the other panel where he's just like... hitting him with the machine gun and stuff. Yeah, it was good. Awesome stuff, dude. Awesome stuff.
I think they were both hunting poachers, and that's why they were in Africa.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And it was at that same comic shop that I managed to fish the original Wolverine miniseries out of their quarter bin. I think they were maybe water damaged or just low-grade copies. And, you know, it's one of those things, you'll have these books that are popular, and because they're popular, they're everywhere, and so you never think they're going to be worth anything. And then enough of them, you know, filter out and get banged up, and then they're still to demand because they're key books that, you know, I could buy that book out of a quarter bin at one point, and I don't know what those issues go for now, but I know they're not cheap either.
Oh, I just found out I have I remember buying the first appearance of Deadpool in a Rob Liefeld comic, The New Mutants.
Mm-hmm.
I have that book, and it's in pretty good shape, and I saw what it was going for, and I'm like, holy shit. And I bought this at a fucking gas station just because I was like, well, this looks kind of cool. And it's not even Deadpool yet. It's like the
skinny Liefeld version.
Yeah, it's a ripoff, the DC ripoff one. So I'm like, what's his name? Deathstroke. Yeah, it's kind of the Deathstroke ripoff. So I was like, it's crazy what these books are worth now. And I'm like, I was going through my boxes the other day because I'm going to start trying to get rid of stuff. And I forgot I bought a bunch of the animated Batman comics at one time. And I have like the fucking first issue of Harley Quinn, like when she first popped up in a comic book. And I'm looking, I'm like, I own this shit? Like, when did I fucking buy this? So it's kind of weird finding all this random shit in my boxes when I'm like, I think I'll go through my boxes one more time real slow and take my time to see what's in there.
It killed me because within the last decade, I was going to a comic shop. They were getting out of comics. They were more into gaming and shit. They're barely open anymore. And they literally had probably 50 copies of New Mutants number 98 for $1 a piece, plus probably a full long box of nothing but X-Force number 2. And I'm like, why would I buy one of those? You know, even for $1, why would I bother to buy one of those? And now I could have made a small fortune off of selling that shit.
Yeah. Well, in my case, over the pandemic, I've been going back through looking to see my gaps in my Iron Man collection, and all of my Lynn Kaminsky stuff is either, I don't know where it is. It's gone. I've searched the entire house. It's gone. So now I'm like, okay, was that, we had financial issues. I lost a bunch of stuff in a storage unit back in the day. And I'm like, did I buy all that stuff pre-storage unit? And I thought this whole time I still had it. So I was like, okay, well, I'll start, you know, buying this stuff. So I'm finding lots where you can buy issues for like 75 cents each. And then I hit this Lynn Kaminsky first appearance of War Machine. And those two issues were, because War Machine's first appearance, he was Tony Stark, and Tony Stark passes away and gives the armor to James Rhodes. But there's one where it's like the splash page, the last page of the book, where he introduces the War Machine armor as Tony Stark, and the next issue he's fighting these dudes in that armor. Those two issues are like $150 each. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me, dude? War Machine? Are you kidding? Because it's got War Machine spray painted over the Iron Man logo on the front.
And I know like, exactly what you're talking about.
Dude, it's great. It's an incredible cover, but it was Iron Man in the 90s. Nobody gave a shit about this stuff. And sure enough, the prices are so ridiculous. To fill out that part of my collection, I'm just going to have to buy like a trade paperback that collects those few issues
and just put it
in its place.
Yeah, what kills me is that the Deadpool first appearance came out in New Mutants at a time where they were probably selling a good 500,000 copies a month, maybe closer to 1 million copies a month now that I think about it. And Iron Man wasn't selling for shit. So there's a legitimate supply and demand issue with that book, because Iron Man was selling, what, maybe 150,000, 200,000 copies at that point at best. So there's literally not a ton of those out there. And so you've got a bunch of guys here grabbing it just because it's a key issue and ties to the MCU, and you're royally fucked because you're the one guy who like legitimately owned it, bought it new, absolutely deserved to have it, and nope, you can't have it.
So check it out. And then following that, when Tony Stark comes back, he's in the modular armor, which looks a lot more close to the MCU armor. This is totally has nothing to do with Wolverine, but we're going to talk about it. So there's a story out called Crash and Burn, where they basically put all of these like hot characters in Iron Man's book. So he fights like Omega Red because Omega Red was hot. He fights Venom because Venom was hot. He fights Thunderstrike because Thunderstrike. I know. And then it ends with Iron Man fighting Hulk, and he's the first donning of the Hulkbuster armor. Well, because Omega Red's issue, super expensive. Venom's issue, super expensive. Thunderstrike issues, not so expensive. And then the Hulkbuster issue, super expensive. And I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? Like, this, nobody else read. I was the only person on Earth who read these issues when they came out. And now this shit's worth like $40, $50, $60 a comic book. And I'm like, get out of here with this bullshit. But it's like you said, it's supply and demand. Those issues legitimately didn't get printed. Like, maybe they sold 30,000 copies, maybe? And how many have survived these 20 years? Whereas the X-Men stuff, I don't understand. There's millions of copies of this shit. But anyway, I digress. But this is just funny you brought that up, where you were just like stunned by the cost of some of these comic books, these random early 90s to late 90s comic books, because they were never supposed to be worth anything. And suddenly it's like, oh, here we go. Now they're actually worth something. It's so hilarious.
But it just goes to show too. It's like, remember when nobody gave a shit about Iron Man, and now everybody still gives a shit about Iron Man. Even though, you know, this would have been probably one of the points where Mr. Fix-It really starts to come in, because you've got What If number 6, the Inferno issue, and then number 7, the issue, the Rob Liefeld, Jim Valentino one, where he joins S.H.I.E.L.D. Now, you had both of those, didn't you?
Yes. So there's the Wolverine joins S.H.I.E.L.D., which was a great one. The cover was by Liefeld?
Yeah, but something about, I think Terry Austin, or no, Scott Williams inked him, and with that inking, and to some extent the coloring, it looked like Art Adams mixed with Jim Lee. It was like, I don't know that Liefeld ever did a better cover than that.
I remember, like, I own a bunch of them. I still have the What If the Fantastic Four Had Different Powers. I didn't realize that was a fucking Todd McFarlane cover.
No, sorry, Rob Liefeld cover.
No, the one with the Fantastic Four?
Oh, my bad. I thought you were talking about the S.H.I.E.L.D. cover. Sorry.
No, there's Fantastic Four, then there's my personal favorite, the Wolverine Inferno story arc, where, you know, Wolverine's like a demon hitman, and they feed him a baby as payment and shit, and he's like gobbling a baby. And it's just like, I remember reading that and being like, this is so fucked up. But I mean, it was great.
Yeah, see, my whole thing was, by 89, I was getting into real deal bad motherfucker anti-heroes like Martial Law and Grimjack. And so the comics Service Code approved shenanigans of Wolverine just weren't doing it for me anymore. But what ifs were always bloodthirsty and they always went further than anything else. And so seeing Wolverine in that state, and especially when he stabs, actually I think it's his animated skeleton that stabs Mordo in the back after Mordo had killed Kitty Pryde. And I was just like, yeah, you know, I love that moment. Literally, I'm reading it like on this, if I remember correctly, I got that comic on a day where we'd been robbed. Somebody had broken into our house and stole some stuff. And so I'm sitting on the steps waiting for the cops to come to get the report, you know, take a report and shit. And, you know, I'm just going through the story. And when I hit that moment, I literally was like, yes! So, you know, again, you got a pretty strong memory tied into that. So I definitely love that. But damn, also,
dude, like mine was like, we went to the grocery store, like our local Kroger's, and I bought it at Kroger's. And remember reading it. Like, we're rocking up and down the aisle and I'm reading the book and just like, yeah, I have to own it.
Well, that had Ron Lim-Art too, back for like one of his earliest works at Marvel, I think.
Is it?
I think he'd done that'd be like some Cy-Force and shit. I don't know if he'd started on Silver Surfer yet, but he's still very much in that X-Mutants mode. And so he was a little grittier than he used to be. I think he had a good inker too. So it's, I don't know, it just had a pizzazz to it that Ron Lim was great in his day, but I thought he was particularly good when he was still kind of finding himself at Marvel before he started to become the machine that was just cranking shit out. And then, of course, we've talked about the What If in the past. You know, pretty cool Rob Liefeld art, a neat Jim Valentino story, awesome cover, and just, you know, me being a kid who grew up reading Nick Fury, Stranko stories, to have two of my favorite things, Nick Fury and Wolverine together in one comic book, total turn on, very into that one, and very much enjoyed it. So I had a rekindling of the stuff I liked about Wolverine when he was allowed to be less of a pussy in What If.
Yeah.
And then, of course, 1989 is also the year that we get the three-part Acts of Vengeance, Mandarin guest appearance, where they update Psylocke and all that cool Wolverine material drawn by Jim Lee. And then going into 1990, Marvel had to know what they had there, because Jim Lee kept drawing covers, particularly of Wolverine, not necessarily the key series, but like it seemed like every opportunity they had to throw a Wolverine cover at Jim Lee, they did so. He's on like Marvel Age, and he did that one Wolverine cover that everybody remembers where he's leaping at you and it's got the speed lines and the orange background. And Jim Lee drawing Wolverine made Wolverine cool again, I felt like.
What are we, Barry Windsor Smith, Marvel Comics?
Not quite, but we're getting close though. So another key issue, Uncanny X-Men number 268, Madripoor Nights. Now this might be where Mac starts to come in. You remember this one, Mac?
X-Men 268?
Mm-hmm. You'll know it.
Oh, yeah. Captain America, Black Widow on the cover.
Oh, yeah, that cover.
Oh, yeah. The what could have been if we lived in an alternate reality where the Avengers were famous and not the X-Men. And Captain America and Black Widow looked better than any other incarnation of themselves in the entire 1990s. And it only occurred...
That was the short hair Black Widow, right?
Yeah, in the gray suit. She looked awesome. Yeah. Just tragic. Tragic.
Cap always looked cool, so...
I still have the t-shirt of the splash page of Cap leaping out at the hand ninjas.
You can't say Cap always looks cool because we were reading Dave Hoover shit, okay? Like, this is contemporary to Dave Hoover, okay? This is not...
I think maybe Rick Levins was doing it at this point.
Oh, shout out Rick Levins. You're just making my...
Actually, I'm talking shit, but actually might have still been Ron Lim at that point. And that was like the last time Cap looked good until Ron Garney.
Yeah, and like the Kieron Dwyer stuff was good too, but that predates this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
But we're not comparing Kieron Dwyer to Jim Lee. You know, that's not fair. That ain't
no,
right.
But he's still he and Zek are my two favorite artists from that era.
Mm-hmm.
But none of this stuff was Jim Lee. I mean, it was like this is why a Cap and Iron Man and Avengers is selling what they are instead of selling Uncanny X-Men numbers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Jim Lee was like almost like the apotheosis of everything everybody wanted from their comic book art in 1990. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And that was a cool-ass story, too. It was a little weird that somehow Black Widow was around during World War II since it was set in that time period, but otherwise, pretty sweet.
I don't remember it to that level. I just remember the panel. I remember the cover and the different panels where I'm like, that's Captain America, dude. That's Captain America. How do I buy this book? I can't. It's just, I have to buy some Muti book to do it? Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, it was glorious. I love that so much. And that was also in the time period. I didn't gravitate toward Marvel Comics Presents because I didn't like like how Wolverine was handling there, and most of the stories weren't really grabbing me either. But
wait, hold on. Wait, can I interrupt you?
Sure, go ahead.
Can I just say, there's a story that Jim Lee's Uncanny X-Men number 268 cover sold for $300,000 in December of 2020.
The artwork or what?
Yeah, the OG art. Yeah. 300 grand.
I think I remember that. That didn't make the legit news.
It says, for $300,000 price, there was more than just the original art page. It includes three overlays, including a hand-inked cityscape for the background, another serving as a color guide.
Nice. I mean, it's a great cover. You can see where the extra effort went into that.
Yeah, I mean, you've already got Wolverine on it, but then, you know, with the popularity of the Avengers going through the freaking stratosphere, mm-hmm. it, like, retroactively makes it even cooler than it was back then. So,
and it was already really fucking cool.
And apparently this dude bought it for $650.
What?
Yeah. He said Scott Williams said he sold it for $650 back in 1990.
There you go. Well, $650 in 1990 was serious money, too. I mean, the original art market was nowhere near what it would become 10 years later.
Nowadays you can't pick up anything. It sucks.
Yeah, so it says right here. It says, for his part, Williams tweets that he hasn't had any second thoughts on the sale in 30 years. It's funny. No regrets looking back, Williams writes. $650 was a huge amount of money for a brand new cover back then.
I remember buying, like, I have artwork. I'm sure that's, like, worth some amount of cash now.
Yeah, certainly.
But I'm saying, like, more than I paid for back then. I mean, I own, the last four pages of the Demon series, Garth Ennis and John McCrae. I own, like, that whole, the last four pages. I wonder if that goes for anything.
We're getting distracted. Continue.
Well, that and I own a bunch Shiny of Manor art. Nobody's picking that shit up off of me, so.
I still got that page you bought me, dude.
Cool. That's worth more than anything else I got, too. So Marvel Comics Presents number 64 was when they started the story arc with Ghost Rider teaming up with Wolverine, featuring Mark Texier artwork. I think it was one of the first times Tex ever drew Wolverine, and I was already a fan of Ghost Rider, so that got me finally buying Marvel Comics Presents on a regular basis. And then I think you get to one of the flashpoints with Wolverine, one of the last, hugely popular eras, 1991. They had pushed Silvestri off of Uncanny X-Men because they wanted Jim Lee to take it over. Around the same time, Larry Hama from G.I. Joe started writing Wolverine, and Hama had a really good sense of action storytelling, something that I think a lot of the people who'd been doing the Wolverine book up to that point struggled with. You know, those action movie beats. Hama really had that down, and that it was kind of Silvestri's forte, too. So it seemed to me like Wolverine had kind of struggled in that time period. I think Fixit will agree, since, you know, he's basically saying the same thing. And I think that really started to put Wolverine as a solo book on the map in a way that he hadn't been since probably the earliest issues. Did you ever read any of that material, Fix It?
On which one?
The Silvestri Hama run on Wolverine.
Give me kind of an idea what the story arc was.
The one of the big ones, well, that's when they brought in LCD and Albert, the Wolverine robot.
Oh, yeah, the Wolverine clone robot and the little girl.
And then they had that arc that actually had to do multiple printings on, where it was Sabretooth and Nick Fury and Wolverine. And that was when they finally revealed, at least for that time period. I'm not sure where it's at. There was a theory, fan theory at that time period, that Wolverine and Sabretooth were blood relatives, either father and son or brothers. And I think that was the issue where Nick Fury definitively said, we checked the DNA, you guys aren't related. But it still went into multiple printings because people were just nuts over that shit.
I remember I've never read them, but I remember seeing them. Mm-hmm. Especially the Albert one, because I remember, he's like a robot version of Wolverine, right?
Right, and he teams up the little girl that's also a robot. I think that she was from the Daredevil story that Harlan Ellison did, where you had all the little robot girls running around trying to blow up Daredevil. And one survived and teamed up with this Wolverine robot.
I remember that really stuff. Cool, but I don't remember ever reading about it.
I read all that stuff, and I remember being like pissed off that they said that Nick Fury said that they weren't related. I was like, what? Yeah, I mean, I was pissed.
Well, because the big thing, Mutant Massacre, like Sabretooth wasn't shit. Sabretooth was a Power Man, Iron Fist villain. I remember reading some of his appearances in Spider-Man, where he's fighting Black Cat, and Black Cat's luck powers are fucking with him and shit. There was that one Daredevil issue during the Mutant Massacre where he's all like, I kill people, I can't help it, it's my feral nature, just shit like that. And then you had the Mutant Massacre, particularly the two-ish issues of Wolverine, Uncanny X-Men, where you had the first fight, and it's got, I think, a Barry Windsor Smith cover on that one. And then the next one is Alan Davis, and that's the one where Sabretooth is hunting Psylocke through the X-Mansion. And Sabretooth went from a fucking nobody to like the arch nemesis of Wolverine, and everybody fucking knew that shit, and he was just... it was amazing how big Sabretooth got so quickly thanks to the Mutant Massacre.
Yeah, and I got those issues with my brother, who was a huge Sabretooth fan. Mm-hmm. So I think I was mooching off his collection at that point.
So beyond that, another huge moment for Wolverine, continuing to pick up Marvel Comics Presents, issues 72 through 84, Weapon X.
Oh, I remember that.
I never read any of it, but I flip through those issues anytime I get my hands on one because they look so incredible.
Yeah, Barry Smith, it's rare to see an artist, this guy went back to like the late 60s, working at Marvel, or at least the early 70s. And of course, his style changed dramatically going into the 80s. And he was still a name, obviously, when he was coming on to Weapon X, or people were impressed. Ooh, wow, he's going to do a Wolverine story. It felt like Marvel Comics Presents was finally going to really matter. And it did, in that time period. But for a guy who'd already been in the game for, at that point, at least 20 years, and he was being eclipsed, obviously, by a lot of these bigger name guys. But for that period of time, particularly when he was doing Weapon X, Barry Windsor Smith was like one of the biggest guys in comics. It was so good for his career, and he did such incredibly intricate work. And it was a fairly unusual story. It's a kind of artsy for a Wolverine story, and it just like exploded in those early issues. I remember they were going for quite a bit of money, and suddenly everybody wanted to do material like that. Barry Windsor's style started seeping into other artists' work, including Jim Lee, and they were all wanting to draw Wolverine that era with the fucking helmet on and the tubing and all that kind of shit. Everybody suddenly wanted to draw that shit, just like Barry Smith had.
Yeah, I always remember the splash page after he breaks out and he's like fighting all he's like throwing dudes in the air, and it's so incredible looking, dude. I mean, Barry Windsor Smith is one of my all-time favorites, and even though I don't care about Wolverine at all, although I've read lots of Wolverine stuff, we haven't touched on a lot of it yet, but I've read Wolverine stuff. I'm still just Googling it and looking at some of these pages. I'm just blown away by this stuff. Just absolutely blown away by it. See how it would take a character who's already like on fire and just stratospheres, dude. We're just blowing this character up.
And then Fix It, I'm pretty sure you read the What If where Wolverine was the Lord of the Vampires and Punisher was hunting him and shit, right?
Yeah. I own that issue. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was Tom Morgan artwork, so maybe not quite the level of the other two issues, but I still really enjoyed it. And that was one of the last issues of What If I bought.
Did we totally skipped over the Frank Miller miniseries, right?
Yeah, we're gonna circle back to that.
Okay, go for it.
And then, of course, another one of those huge flashpoints, one of the highlights, certainly of Uncanny X-Men, if not the totality of comics, Uncanny X-Men 275 with the gatefold cover.
Internet, save us. I don't know these numbers, man.
Oh, shit, man. I hate when he does research and I don't.
Oh, yeah, that one. Is that a big deal cover?
That was huge, because that was the announcement, I think the grand announcement that Jim Lee is here. Because you have to understand, he did those three issues and he was still doing Punisher work in that time period, and he took a little time off, unfortunately, because I don't know if it was a burnout or what was going on, but there was a period where he was kind of away from the comics. And so you had the three issue arc, and then a little ways later you had Gambit introduced, and you had the Wills Portacio. What's that?
Nothing. Go ahead.
You had the Wills Portacio one where with the Shadow Thief, Shadow King, and then they had the whole Mutant Genesis thing amping up to that. Extinction Agenda. So Jim Lee had done some covers for that, but I don't think he was doing the interiors. They had a lot of filling guys in that time period. And then just a little bit before 275, you had Jim Lee as the full artist, although he did have another one where he had to like team up with a bunch of artists to kind of push the issue out. But 275, it was extra length. It was, again, the X-Men versus the Shi'ar and the Imperial Guard and some Skrulls. And you had that Jim Lee Wolverine chopping people up and kicking all kinds of ass. You had the Starjammers looking cooler than they would ever look. Like, you look at that cover and you want to read a Starjammers book, and that didn't really ever happen again.
Yeah, never.
Yeah, and it launched into a pretty badass science fantasy story arc, and then that led into the Mutant Genesis, where everybody was fighting on Muir Island with the Shadow King, and all the teams got reconfigured, and then that leads into X-Men number 1, and the reason why X-Men number 1 sold 8 million copies, besides the fact that they had the multiple cover scheme and it was a new X-Men number 1, it's because the Jim Lee that everybody suddenly wanted, Jim Lee's full manifestation was in 275, where you saw that this was the future of comics, and that was the point where everybody decided they were going to all buy X-Men, and then they really all bought X-Men with X-Men number 1. So, and again, Wolverine was a fucking badass, killing Skrulls with his claws and shit. You were getting to see him be a badass again, too, besides him looking great under Jim Lee and Scott Williams.
Now, is that X-Men number 1 still the bar for, like, the most number 1 issue sold or anything?
Still, yeah.
Still? Okay. I just remember going to shops and seen like just fucking stacks of the books.
Mm-hmm. And so I personally think that Weapon X ran a little long, but I did like that there was a whole big thing about teasing the mystery of who Wolverine is. Like, fix it. Can you want to tell the story, like the basics of who was Wolverine? Like, what was revealed in Weapon X?
Well, he was a mutant who had healing capabilities. Are we talking about the ones where he has like the helmet and shit? And
yeah,
they're doing that whole fucking virtual reality training with him, and they're training him to be, I guess, Weapon X. And he has the claws. He's running around naked half the time. And he had the cool fucking dome. And I mean, are we ever going to get to the movie, man? I'm just wondering, like.
We're almost there. The movie
does a great job of explaining. Well, I don't know. Even that, I just watched the two movies, and yeah, I mean,
well, let's get to the movie part first. Then we're almost there.
I mean, he's a mutant. That's it.
No worries. It's good. So I liked how artsy Weapon X was, and I like how ambiguous a lot of it was, because one of the great things about Wolverine, one of the things we all glommed to in the early days, was he was an amnesiac. He did not know his past. He did not know how he got the adamantium and skeleton, the claws, any of that stuff. And a lot of his stories was about him searching for his past. And generally speaking, he couldn't get back further than when the Hudsons found him in Canada. And so kept that mystery for years and years going.
Now, let me see if you can frank this, because I've always wondered.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Alan Moore wrote V for Vendetta.
Yep.
And V for Vendetta has a very similar background for V. Did that come out before Wolverine, or Wolverine came out before that?
I don't know that I really would agree that they're all that similar, but I would
You have V, who's part of this experiment, and, you know, he breaks out.
I see where you're coming from now. I thought you were talking about similarities between the Frank Miller miniseries.
No.
Yeah, probably there was some influence there, because Weapon X was years after V for Vendetta. V for Vendetta
was published
in the States around 87, 88, but it had already run serialized in the UK. I don't think they'd finished the story there, but it was running in one of the magazines there, probably Warrior or something. And so Barry Smith, being a British guy, would certainly have been exposed to that material, I'm sure.
Okay, because it had a very, I don't want to say like, you know, homage or anything. They just felt like in the same vein, kind of.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if Alan Moore had influenced. I have a hard time seeing how Barry Windsor Smith's writing couldn't have been influenced by Alan Moore based on the type of material they were doing.
But I'm not seeing nothing there, right? I mean, there's something there, right?
I've never seen it myself, but I agree. I think that you probably are onto something there.
Okay. I was wondering, because I remember when we were talking about doing this, I was watching the movies, and I'm thinking about Wolverine. I'm like, it felt kind of like, you know, the secret organization. They're testing this person that's special. They're gonna turn him into a weapon. They both escape. One of them, it's in, you know, the building burns, and he turns to be V because the Roman numeral on his door. And Wolverine is called Weapon X because he's the 10th generation of this weapon. And it just felt, you know, in the same vein.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. Yeah, that sounds okay. I was never a big, you know, you're more of a Moore guy than I'll ever be. And I've read V for Vendetta, I think once or twice, and I saw the movie once, it's not a frame of reference that is handy to me. You know, it doesn't automatically come up, but you're mentioning these similarities, and I sounds right to me.
Okay, yeah, because I mean, like, I'm a big of a Moore fan. I like reading. I think I read V for Vendetta maybe once every few years, just to that or Miracle Man, just to kind of like, you know, recharge my desire to read comics, because Alan Moore or his Swamp Thing, something like that, always kind of like brings me back into comics when I get burned out on it. So, okay, I just wanted to see if you were going to frank that or not, because I was like, I just wanted to ask somebody.
So probably one of the last big story arcs in Marvel Comics Presents was Peter David and Sam Keith doing Wolverine against Cyber, this new villain they came up with, who had, I think, adamantium armor. And I like Sam Keith's artwork, and I was reading my brother's copies of both Weapon X and the Cyber story, but I was definitely starting to lose interest there. And then what I really was having trouble with was I've been reading Wolverine, and I wasn't enjoying it, in part because Larry Hama started to address the Barry Windsor Smith stuff, and basically he didn't like some of the answers that Smith gave, and I think he was maybe trying to preserve the mystery of Wolverine. But what he did to is he countered so much information in that story that it just felt like he was negating what little progress was made in learning anything about Wolverine. And I'm not one to want to know everything about that character, but Hama took it to a level where it's like, nothing is real, nothing makes sense, we don't know anything, we're never going to know anything. And they also had that stupid 50th issue where it had the die cut cover, like Wolverine had slashed a file folder, a manila folder, and it was just sort of the last straw for me at that point. I was just tired of Wolverine, I was tired of Silvestri work on the book, and I was tired of the runaround. And then you looked at X-Men, they're playing with that material too, particularly with their introduction of Maverick and Omega Red. And again, it's one of these teases, like, you don't know about the time that there was a secret Russian counterpart to Weapon X, and you and I fought. And of course, the dude doesn't look in any way like a period character. He looks like a brand new Chromium Age character, but he's supposed to have been around back in the 60s or some shit. And I was just getting tired of them teasing shit with Wolverine that wasn't going to amount to anything. And I think 1992 was like the apex of the overexposure. Wolverine was in every goddamn thing. They did the story arc where Wolverine went back to Japan to face the mafia there, the Yakuza. And I think that they had that one Asian mobster that was working with the Mandarin in the Acts of Vengeance arc. And he sets up a scenario where Wolverine's lady love, Mariko, is going to have to cut off one of her fingers as sort of like an honor, to help reclaim her family honor or some shit like that. And the dude had poisoned the knife, and so Mariko dies. And they'd been building up that character going back to like 79 as, you know, one of the loves of Wolverine's life. And so when she dies, for me, it's like that was one of the last times Wolverine was trying to become the samurai. And one of the things I liked about Wolverine, or one of the ways I was able to forgive him for not being as cool as he used to be, was he's trying to become a better person. He's trying to become a higher caliber of warrior and have a philosophy and all that kind of stuff. And it seemed to me like once they killed off Mariko, he just became full-on feral savage asshole guy.
Yeah.
And there was a cool guest appearance in one of the Marvel UK books, Warheads, where I think that they gave him credit for permanently disfiguring one of the members of the team, and had some really cool Gary Erskine art. But most of these guest appearances weren't amounting to much. The lead book I wasn't too into, and they had just about lost me, and then fucking Mark Teixeira starts drawing it. And, you know, I don't know about other people, but for me, one of the great Wolverine artists will always be Mark Teixeira.
Which I own a page, too, with Wolverine and Sabretooth.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Fucking his inking is insane, dude.
And they did just have a...
Just bleeds the paper.
Oh, yeah. And they did have one more strong Marvel Comics Presents story that I was into, because it had Steve Lyle artwork, and it featured the character Typhoid from Daredevil. Zen issues 109 through 116 is collected in a trade called Typhoid's Kiss. And that I dug, but 1992 is sort of my last year with a lot of the Marvel stuff. That's when I finally decided to quit the X-Men books. You know, the Marvel Comics Presents, they'd gotten into the story arc with this character called Lynx. There's basically like a prototype to X-23, but nobody seemed to care. Mark Teixeira left Wolverine to go do the Sabretooth miniseries that Mac's brother was into. Dwayne Turner took over the art, and it wasn't the same. I wasn't going to stay for it. And then finally, he had Fatal Attractions, where they took the adamantium out of Wolverine with the hollow foil cover.
Oh, that's horrible.
And that was the final straw for me. I dropped every X title after Fatal Attractions.
You know what? I think I stopped reading X books around that time, too.
Yeah.
And can I just say, one of the only, like, I hated mutants, right? Like, mm-hmm. I've always been down with muties, right? One of the only runs of comic books that, like, early comic books I collected was that Sam Keith, Peter David, Wolverine, Marvel Comics Presents. I had every single one of those. I didn't have any of the Weapon X stuff, and I didn't have anything after it. But I wanted to get all of that Sam Keith story arc, because it was so weird. I was like, I have, like, what is going on? There was, like, a jaguar god or something. It was so crazy.
Didn't Cyber, like, he secrete, like, some kind of hallucinogen from, like, his...
I don't know.
I think that was Omega Red.
No, Omega Red had the tentacles that would drain you.
But I think it also had poison or something.
Well, no, I want to say Cyber, like, injected Wolverine with something and, like...
Oh, he did have hypodermic needle fingertips, like...
Yes.
Like, Freddy Krueger in Dream Warrior.
Yes. I remember seeing that and thinking that exactly.
But I remember Wolverine stabbed his... cut his eye out or something. Dude, it was, like, super bloody. A bunch of the chicks were, like, most of the way nude in, like, bikini and, like, weird, like, jungle bikinis and stuff. And it was just, like, I was, like... And Wolverine looked so bizarre because Sam Keith. I like, had to collect all that stuff. That is one of, like, the first complete stories that I probably ever actually owned. And I remember hunting everywhere to find every single issue of that Marvel Comics Presents run. When I finally completed it, I was, like, extremely happy. Why? I don't know. I think it was because it was, like, it was a Wolverine story without being, like, an image style, you know, everybody's telling me it's good and Wolverine's popular. It was so different that was the Wolverine I was okay with collecting. I don't know. It was very strange.
And I never remembered you having this interest in Sam Keith. Did you... continue to enjoy his work after that, or was it really that one with story arc?
No, because he went over to the Max, and he was never in anything that I had access to. Mm. So yeah, and you know, the Max ran for so long. No, I loved the Max TV show on MTV. Yes. I was totally into that. And the Head or whatever. But I never got the Max comic books, and you know, some of that stuff after it goes on for so long, you just are like, okay, that's it. Like I can't.
Yeah, I missed my shot at that one. It's just gonna let that one go on without me. Yeah.
Yep. So no, that's like my one and only like real, and I've always loved Sam Keith's stuff, but that's the only Sam Keith and probably really the only Wolverine arc of stories that I like sought out and purchased.
And I don't think Sam Keith ever put in that level of artwork for in terms of pen and ink art. He got more and more into doing mixed media and painting and such. So in terms of that intricacy of artwork and trying to compete with the Image guys while definitely being a very different flavor from them, just competing them in terms of raw detail, I don't know that Sam Keith ever got better in that lane, in that mainstream-ish comics lane than he did in that arc.
Yeah, that's as far as being traditional comic book artist, yeah, that's probably about as traditional as he got, which is still like outrageous, still crazy to look at. I was clicking through some of the panels and pictures, and I was just like, yeah, this is as weird as I remembered it.
My last issue of Wolverine purchased on purpose was in 1994. I bought Wolverine number 90. That was the one that had a wraparound cover by one of the Kubert boys, and I think that they were drawing over a painting by the Hildebrands, which is a weird thing. It was bound with one of the trading cards with one of the X-Men art series, maybe one of the painted series, and that was the one where Wolverine finally popped his claws into Sabretooth's brain, appearing to kill him right before they got into the Age of Apocalypse. And I wanted to see that what appeared at that time to be the final fight between Wolverine and Sabretooth, and then I was content to just let it go on without me and pretty much stay that way forever from that point onward. And then, of course, Wolverine number 100 comes up in 1996, so 2 years later, and you had the whole bone claw thing. And I've always been very anti-bone claw, because for starters,
I hate that.
You go back to like the Madripoor Knight story, why wouldn't Wolverine pop his bone claws when he was hanging out with Captain America? You know, how do you rationalize that? And I hate it. I hate it so much. It doesn't, why you would naturally manifest these claws, and then they just cloated the claws with the adamantium, but there's a bunch of other people that can also pop claws like Wolverine that we've seen.
Well, what always bothered me is their bone. Mm-hmm. And I always assume, because they always show where he's popping people and they kind of break off, and then he grows some new ones and then they break off. Isn't that how they kind of work?
Yeah, mostly. You know, anytime he runs up against something tougher than him, or somebody with a sword can chop them off and shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I was like, someone had one time made a, or someone had written something like a theory that they were actually blades in him, and that he would tense up his arms and that would push the blades forward, and then he would release his arms and they would slide back.
I think that's from the Handbook of Marvel Universe. I think that's literally the entry.
I just remember reading that and I was like, oh, that makes absolute sense why he has claws. Because when they went with the bone claw, I was like, that is so dumb. Like, so you're just saying he's just going to grow his bone? Like, he's basically Bone, that X-Men character who had all the bones out of her.
Marrow.
She would just yank them out and use them like knives?
Yeah, Marrow.
There you go, Marrow. And I'm just like, okay, so what? That's what Wolverine was? Like, that's lame. So, yeah, I really hated the whole he got bones thing. That's so stupid.
And then they were breaking all the fucking time. And I think the idea was maybe they thought he'd gotten too powerful. He was too unbeatable. You couldn't chop off his arm.
Dude, I mean, his healing factor was like ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he would have been immortal the way they had him at one time, where he was a little bit overpowered. I mean, the Hulk could smash him and he would kind of just piece back together and go back to fighting, which was always kind of weird to me.
But I think generally speaking, the majority of the audience wanted him to get the adamantium back, and they built up toward Wolverine 100 with another hologram cover. This one was bigger and it was die cut to actually be somewhat in the shape of Wolverine, so that was nice. But everybody thought he was going to get the adamantium back in number 100, and he didn't. And in fact, he violently rejected the process, and he shot these spikes into people. It was kind of cool how they did that. But I remember I was a retailer by that point, and I remember Wolverine 100 was like when everybody was tired of this shit, and the sales just started plummeting after that, in my personal experience. And it never really recovered, and that was among it basically became something of a death knell for Larry Hama, because he decided what he was going to do instead was Wolverine was going to devolve, and somehow he lost his nose, and he was running around with like finger, like talons and stuff, big fingernails and shit, hanging out with Elektra, looking a little bit like Pitt. And I remember like virtually no one wanted anything to do with that, and it just really created this major backlash against the book, where it was selling well enough for Marvel standards at the time, but they knew that they done fucked up, and it seemed like 1 month they just decided they just dropped that entirely. And I thought they had a nice little run there with Lanil Francis Yu in his early days. I thought he did some really great work, and for a time period they got Chris Claremont back. And you know, I realize I'm lying, I did buy those Claremont Lanil Francis Yu issues in part because I was hoping that Claremont would be able to bring that jazz back, and he couldn't. But I just really love the artwork too. Yu in that time period I thought was just fantastic. But then Eric Larson had his weird little run where he's fighting Galactus, and then getting into 2000 you've got like Steve Scroggie had a little run which I thought was nice looking. Frank Tierra did a long run, which I know Matt's brother bought a lot of that material. I think they had a lot of Sabretooth tie-in stuff, and Frank Tierra did a lot of darker, more fucked up type stuff with the character. And then that lasted until the end of the ongoing Wolverine miniseries, ongoing series, when Daniel Way was writing it. It stopped with issue number 189. And so for me, I kind of lose the thread with Marvel by that point. I'd already pretty much dropped Marvel almost entirely. I was buying some of the Heroes Return stuff, but like that was like the last vestige of me having any interest in X-Men, and I've never bought or read any X-Men stuff pretty much since then. That was like the end of the run for me of having any real interest in Wolverine as a comic book character.
Yeah. Actually, you know what? I think I read some of that Daniel Way stuff of Wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
I think
what they did at sometime around House of M, I think around 2005, is part of one of the things that happened after the No More Mutants thingy is somehow Wolverine got all of his memories back. And so Way did this whole series, I think with Steve Dillon, where he was going after all the people that he'd had in his life that he'd forgotten about or didn't know what his interactions with were, and he suddenly had all these memories again. And so it's him exploring his full history, basically making him a Highlander since he's supposed to date back to at least the 1800s. And I wasn't interested in Wolverine as a Highlander. That wasn't a story that I was interested in following. So that was one of those deals where there was an element of Wolverine that fully broke me, and I just wasn't interested anymore in what anything else he was going to do in the comic books. And it didn't help too, the whole new Avengers thing where he becomes an Avenger. It's like that broke the Avengers for me in comics too. So some things you just don't get over, you know, when they fuck with the concept too much, I think it can break you, and you don't come back from that.
Kind of do a sidebar that Frank Thierry talked shit about me in an article one time. Anyway,
you're not gonna elaborate?
No, we're not. It's Iron, because he did run an Iron Man. He talked shit about me.
Iron Man, really?
Yes, Frank Thierry did an Iron Man run.
I mean, you had some issues with Joe Quesada too, as I recall.
Yeah, this was after that.
Okay.
Yeah, this is after that.
We gotta catch on that someday, but probably an Iron Man one.
No, I don't know if we should, but anyway, let me think where you guys are at. At some point, my brother, when the Uncanny X-Men Essentials were coming out, he had the run that had, you guys mentioned earlier, the Wolverine versus the Hellfire Club, where he gets thrown, you know, the sewer issue with all the doo-doo all over him. And with all of my mutie hate, I'm like, I should read this because this is such a big deal, right? So I read it, and that's when I was like, okay, I kind of get it. This Iron Man, Wolverine's pretty badass, right? But that was way after the fact. This is whenever the Essentials were being first printed, so that was much into the 90s. But I did go back and retroactively read some of that stuff, and I'm like, all right, this stuff's pretty cool. And then I think the Dark Phoenix Saga after that?
No, that was during, actually.
Before that.
Was that all during that, right? Yeah, I read all that. The
thing is, people talk about the Dark Phoenix Saga as though it was planned to be this extended epic, and what really happened was you just had a run of books that had the common theme of the Phoenix Force becoming more and more of an issue, or Jean Grey's power levels and her stability becoming more and more of an issue. It was basically this long-running subplot, and then they decided, like, the last year of that arc, it was one story. And it's like, no, the story really starts with, like, X-Men number 100, and it resolves around 140. So it's really 40 issues, but they tend to talk about the last 12 as though it was intended to be an arc. But yet, all that Hellfire stuff is some of the meat of the Dark Phoenix saga as it's continues to be bound together, essentially.
Okay, sorry. I just have to, you guys are just going off. I'm trying to figure out where my reading actually intersects with the timeline.
Well, while you're doing that, Fix, where, like, Wolverine, was he ever, like, one of your number one favorites or, like, top 10?
Definitely top 10.
Yeah.
For a while. I mean, he's the best at what he does.
And what he does isn't pretty.
Yeah, Murder Machine. I mean, to me, it's always been Hulk. I mean, Hulk's always number one. But, you know, Wolverine was one of those. I mean, I guess it depends on who writes him. He can have some really cool story arcs, but he's kind of one of those characters that you can't kill him. I don't think he's ever really lost a battle.
He's lost a lot of battles. He's lost tons of battles. Yeah, no.
But he always comes back. He always comes back and wins. You know, he's that scruffy little sumbitch that won't stay down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, after rewatching the movie, I wasn't a big fan of the whole Highlander thing where he's been fucking marching through time. It's kind of like, what was your question again? Like, I mean, he's top.
Do you 10. Like, his question is this, do you like Wolverine?
Yeah, I would say yes.
Was he ever like your guy?
No, he's never been my guy. I've never been like running around, you know, pretending I have claws and hacking at
Berserker Rage.
Yeah. Never like, you know, fucking grunting and saying Gene or anything like that. So that's a X-Men the animated cartoon joke.
What one of the best Marvel memes for sure is the Wolverine lying in bed looking at the framed photograph from the cartoon, and then you just use that meme. You put whatever you're longing for,
whatever you want.
The photograph.
No, my favorite has always been the one with Rogue laying on the ground in front of Apocalypse, and it says, "Look at that ass."
I'm not familiar with that one, but anyway,
they definitely gave Rogue a voluptuous body in that cartoon, and she was already in a skin tight costume. And I was like, I never thought about it that way until I saw a meme about it. I was like, that's hilarious.
Well, and it's so funny too, because Rogue was kind of the butch, you know, like regular girl in the early days, and then by the time Jim Lee was done with her, she's a supermodel.
She was kind of like a tomboy, wasn't she?
I kind of read her as lesbian, frankly, and then all of a sudden she's fucking Magneto, and it's like, wait, what?
I always saw her as kind of like a tomboy, you know, country girl, southern, no, not really a Southern Belle, but more like, you know, Daisy Duke.
I always felt like she was a redneck before Jim Lee, and then afterwards she was a Southern Belle.
Okay, I can see that. Yeah, I can see that. She's your trailer trash or what?
Mm-hmm, basically, yeah.
She washes stuff with a rag on a stick.
I mean, she had a fucking skunk stripe in her hair, you know?
Yeah, I forgot about that. Actually, I did like, wasn't there an arc where, like, her and Wolverine are escaping? They're, like, on the top of a train?
Probably. Are you talking about the Japanese stuff?
No, there was,
you're talking about with Rick Leonardi, Genosha. Huh? Genosha, right?
I believe so.
The island that had mutant apartheid?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's when Rick Leonardi was drawing the book. One of my top most hated artist guys that I just really don't enjoy looking at their stuff, especially in that time period, was Rick Leonardi. So I'm aware of those stories. I've tossed through them. I haven't read a lot of them because I just couldn't pass the art.
My number one hated artist is the guy that helped Alex Ross's book, Earth-X.
Yeah, Earth-X, yep.
France, what's his name?
John Paul Leon.
Oh, fuck it. Dude, his artwork just fucking offends me because they did a great Sinister book and his artwork just murders that book.
I think that was the Further Adventures of Cyclops and Phoenix. And yeah, because the first miniseries had that really nice Yin Ha artwork. And yes, it was in the future, and then they did this one in the past, where it was exploring Sinister's history, and I never could read that one for the same reasons, because that's not the artwork I wanted to see on a Sinister book, and I like Sinister a lot, but I couldn't read that book.
I think I bought that first issue, and was like, no, you know what, I think I'm okay. I didn't buy any more.
So, yeah, Mac, did you ever find the stuff you did read?
I'm telling you, I read the Sam Keith Marvel comics and stuff. I wasn't leaving that open-ended. I said, and then you were getting further and further away from the Uncanny X-Men stuff.
Okay.
So I interjected the... Gotcha. And then I read the Frank Miller miniseries, but skipped right past that, so fuck you.
Well, because we're coming to that. So,
how are we coming back to it? We're in the early 2000s. How are we coming back to the Frank Miller stuff from 80-fucking-3?
But wait a minute. Wasn't there a time there where they were dropping Wolverine in, like, everybody's book?
Yeah, 92.
Okay.
Yeah, that was 1989 through 2021.
I just remember one time going to a shop and like every Marvel book I flipped through, Wolverine was somewhere in that book. And I was like, this is really fucking weird.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, God. The shelves were full of Wolverine in the early 90s, especially. So we saw, I don't think Mac was there because, you know, damn dirty muties, but I believe that Fix-It, Pussycat, and me saw X-Men The Last Stand in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And from the first X-Men movie in 2000, they put one out every 3 years. And because it was The Last Stand, the one that came out 3 years later was X-Men Origins Wolverine. It was released May 1st, 2009, directed by Gavin Hood, written by David Benioff of ruining Game of Thrones' ending fame, and Skip Woods, who had done Swordfish, the A-Team movie, one of the Die Hard sequels, one of the Hitman movies, where the X-1 and X-2 had quadrupled their production budgets. X-Men Origins Wolverine about doubled it, $150 million price tag, $373 million earned. I don't know, did any of us see that theatrically? Fixit, did you watch that in the theater?
I did see it in the theater.
How'd you feel about it when you saw it?
I want to say I was excited because they had a lot of X-Men in it. I was like super pumped. Like, I'm like, well, shit, look, they're talking about Deadpool and they're talking about fucking the Blob and Gambit and like Cyclops. Like, I remember like being excited that they were showing all these characters that I didn't think was like the Blob. I never thought I'd see the fucking Blob in an X-Men movie. I mean, granted, it's a skinny dude in a fat suit, which was kind of weird. Like, rewatching it, I was just like, oh wow, it's a little cringy when he comes on and just the stuff he's doing and talk about falling in love with the chick and I don't know. Now the Will.i.am character, I don't remember him being in the comics.
He was. Will.i.am played John Wraith. He was introduced in 1992's Wolverine number 60, so that was right before the Tex era, and most of his appearances were drawn by Tex. So
Zero?
That guy in a cowboy hat kind of tends to stand out in a comic book.
So what about Zero, the one with the guns?
My understanding is that Agent Zero is actually the first Maverick, the one that Jim Lee introduced in the X-Men titles, that he had the yellow armor with the stripes and shit.
Yes.
And of course he wasn't an Asian man in that, but that character, if I recall correctly, died from the Legacy virus, and then he was replaced by another guy called Bolt, who looked similar to him in the electrical powers. And so what they did is they took those two Mavericks and they split them up and radically altered them so they were barely recognizable, which is going to be a theme in this movie. And okay. So Bolt is the one that Dominic Monaghan.
Is that the lost. Hobbit? Like, that's
the Hobbit dude, playing? Yeah. And okay. And the character he's playing was introduced in 1995's X-Men Unlimited number 8, which was after I was done reading this stuff. And again, he was Maverick for the entire run of the solo Maverick series that only lasted about 10 issues or so. But, you know, to see him being the quirky little guy with the electrical powers exclusively was like, well, that's not the character from the Maverick books. And of course, the Asian fellow, what is that fellow's name? I've got notes. Don't I? Shit. Maybe I don't. There he is. Okay. So the fellow's name is Daniel Henney, and he's supposed to be playing Maverick, but they call him Agent Zero, and his whole thing is he's got Gunkata, essentially, and yeah. He's like one of the more vicious of the people in the Team X group they put together for the movie.
And then of course they show like Cyclops and Emma Frost.
But only the Diamond Heart version from yeah. Grant Morrison's run, except with absolutely none of the personality, sexuality, backstory. Basically nothing is right besides that she gets Diamond Heart skin like with Morrison.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. And they had to fucking squeeze Scott Summers into this shit. God. Dude, like,
the fact they squeezed in Professor X, and I'm like, oh, man. The crazy thing is when I rewatched it, I totally forgot that ending. The whole Alamandian bullet and all that bullshit, I had totally forgot about that.
Oh, God, yes. So the reason why
oh, shit, this is like, I remember what, because you told us watch them. So I'm like, well, let me rewatch it. And I'm thinking, and in my head, I had this very nostalgic, oh, I remember really liking this movie and thinking it was kind of cool. And I'm watching them like, okay, the intro's kind of cool. The Highlander, okay, that's kind of cool. And then, you know, they show the Blob and, you know, the unmovable object. And I go, okay, that's kind of, and I'm like, all right, this stuff's kind of cool. And then they talk about the island and then like Scott Summers pops up. I'm like, what? And I did remember the whole Deadpool from this one because I watched Deadpool not too long ago, a few months ago. So I remember like seeing that scene. I'm like, oh, I remember that scene. But I just totally forgot about that. Literally after Deadpool gets killed and all that shit, I totally forgot that part of the movie. And I remember thinking like, how are they going to connect this to the other movies? And this was the moment I realized, like, you need a Kevin Feige for this kind of shit. Like, none of Wolverine's movies make sense anymore now to me after watching these two movies.
I'm curious, and you're an opening day kind of dude. You catch at least opening weekend.
Oh yeah.
So you're going into this with enthusiasm. You haven't heard the bad feedback yet. So you actually think this might be a good movie and a return to greatness for the X-Men movies, and just like got gut punched essentially.
Fuck yeah, dude! Especially that ending. Because I remember I was watching. I'm like, wait a minute. And the second one, or like I'm sitting and I'm thinking about the X-Men movies, and I'm like, well, but that's not how they did his ending. Like, you know, he beat Stryker in DC, and it's the 60s, but this seems to be the 90s, and he knows Stryker now. And I'm like, wait, what? Like,
no, the period detail is terrible, but as best I can tell, they pick up Sabretooth and Wolverine scene in the Vietnam War, and therefore the movie should be taking place sometime in the early 80s, in that time frame, late 70s, early 80s. Though you can't tell that from any of the costumes or anything, but that's the only thing that makes sense, because he was supposed to be 6 years out from that program. Now you figure he probably spent a few years in the Team X program, so let's say it's at the end of Vietnam War that they get captured, and then he spends, say, 5 years with the Team X group, and then another 6 years. So the latest it could be would be 86.
But then if you watch First X-Men, when Professor X and Magneto go and ask Wolverine if he wants to join the team and tell him they're going to fuck themselves, that's in the 70s.
No, even earlier than that. I think that was in the 60s.
Is it like late 60s maybe?
No, I think probably about 63, because it's supposed to be during the Cuban Missile Crisis, right?
Yeah. So like, I was like, this dude, like, he's fucked, dude. His movies don't make any sense.
It's worth noting, though, that the X-Men First Class had not come out yet at that point. X-Men First Class won't come out until 2011.
But none of them ever take in consideration the movies before it. They just kind of make up their own history for him. They're like, well, Wolverine was here, though he should have been in, I'm assuming, Project X at the time, and being brainwashed. Like, literally every movie has him somewhere else. It was so fucking weird. So watching this one, I mean, it was kind of cool until we got to the Alamanium bullets, and that was when I tuned out. I'm like, oh yeah, this is bad. Like,
so we're jumping around a lot. Mac, you're not an X-Men guy, but you did watch this movie. Can you give us like the 2-minute version of what the fuck happens in this thing and how that made you feel?
Okay, quick recap. Wolverine lives on a hill in Canada. Wolverine chops down wood in Canada, and he got a girlfriend. He has flashbacks to when he was a movie opens, baby Wolverine, child Wolverine, kills his own daddy, and Victor is there, quote unquote Victor, aka Sabretooth. Then you fast forward through how they're on the run because he killed his daddy, and then they kind of grow up through time, and it's the Highlander stuff, like Mr. Fixit was saying, where they're fighting in Las Vegas, and they're fighting, or not Las Vegas, where'd I get Las Vegas? Vietnam, they're fighting in Vietnam. They're fighting at the Caesar's Palace. Where did I say that? They were fighting at World War II, and you're going through all these different wars and what. Oh, it was the Civil War, then World War II, and then Vietnam. And that's when he's a falling out with this like special forces group of all these hopped up super soldiers or whatever. And they're commanded by General Stryker, who we know from X2, who's the guy who makes the mutant machine. He makes a mutant machine.
That was Magneto, dude.
I thought it was. What was Stryker doing?
Stryker was the one who's going to use Cerebro to kill all the mutants.
He's using the secretion of his son's brain to like
reverse
control Lady Deathstrike in them.
Yeah, reverse mutant machine. He was trying to make a machine to kill all the mutants, right?
Wait, didn't he was doing the Sentinels too, wasn't he? No, that's Task. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, so anyway,
part of Task Group. See, that's so fucking. He was part of Task Group as a young guy. He's there in Paris whenever fucking.
That's still going to be Days of Future Past though. So that movie hasn't been made yet.
I'm trying to. Okay, so anyway, they're you know, whatever. They start killing all these like village people or whatever. Not the village people.
MCA.
Yeah, it was folks in a village in Vietnam, right? And they're trying to figure out. He's obviously got adamantium, and he's trying to figure out where more of it is. And this African dude. No, it was an African village.
By the way, I just had to point out it irritated me because it's supposed to be a meteor that landed, and that's like no, that's vibranium. That's not adamantium.
Well, no, remember, I think there's a scene where Stryker says that it's one of the components used to create a new element.
It's still stealing vibranium.
Oh, it doesn't matter.
It bugs me because the whole reason why adamantium exists is because they were trying to replicate vibranium artificially, and they couldn't, and they stumbled upon adamantium instead.
Let me ask a quick question, especially to you, Frank, because I doubt Mag did.
This
when
is not
you were younger, at any time, did you go ask a science teacher about adamantium, if it really existed?
I didn't, because there was an entry in the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, and I figured that was kind of a tell.
Fuck you. Okay, then I'm the only person there. It was truly disappointing.
You say that, but I guarantee you there's a whole generation of kids that think Wakanda vibranium are real.
No, I don't dispute that. I think that I'm laughing just because more of your reaction than anything else. I can totally see a kid asking a teacher that.
I remember going to my science teacher and asking him if it existed and him giving me a blank stare. And I started explaining what it is. And now that I say it as an adult, I'm like, at what point did he just look at me like, this is what I'm teaching? Like, fuck.
You were like,
I really thought that was an element.
Okay, anyway,
teach them well and let them lead the way. Sure.
Let me continue with the movie. Okay. So then we flash forward to Wolverine's chopping down wood. Find out that Victor Creed, aka Sabretooth, whatever. He's going through and he's picking off all of the old members of this unit. Stryker shows up to tell Wolverine, hey, man, you got to help me find Victor. He's going around killing everybody. And he's like, you know, go fuck yourself, whatever. And then Victor kills his girlfriend. And that throws Wolverine into a rage. He joins Stryker into the Weapon X program, gets injected with the adamantium. He overhears in a really stupid moment where he's inside the cocoon getting the adamantium injected into his body, which I would say that part was cool where they're showing the drills drill into his body
and they have pump they heat it up. Like yeah, and the tips of the drill heating pumping up.
It's molten adamantium being pumped into his body. That was cool. Mm-hmm. It was when Stryker turns and he's just like, oh, we're going to fucking kill this dude anyway, or some stupid like that. And he overhears it and that's what flips him and he breaks out of the thing. And I'm like, this is dumb. If that actually happened in the comic book, that's horrible.
It didn't.
I didn't think it did. So then he goes, you know, Berserker Barrage, and he breaks out and he's using his shiny claws now. Then yada, yada, yada. You find out that Victor Creed was doing all this stuff working for Stryker, and it was to get Wolverine to join the Weapon X program. And they were taking one of the members.
DNA samples from mutants.
Yeah. They were taking
Slade Wilson is Deathstroke. Wade Wilson is Deadpool.
Right. Total coincidence there, everybody. Don't read into that. They thought he'd been killed by Victor Creed, but really he was like, what is Weapon 11 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're taking all the DNA from all these mutants and putting it into Deadpool to become like the uber assassin mutant. And then they Wolverine makes to some island to save.
Thanks to Gambit.
Thanks to Gambit. And I'm sure that I have in my notes, you know, the dude playing Gambit was like, this is it. This is my whole career. I'm going to be Gambit, one of the most popular X-Men characters. This movie's going to blow up and then I'm going to get my whole spinoff series. And we never fucking see from this dude ever. Because
he's in the John Carter of Mars movie that also bombed hugely. So they kept trying to make him happen.
Was he Gambit, motherfucker?
No. Oh, you mean Gambit? Yeah.
Thank you.
But every time I kept seeing Gambit in the movie, I kept thinking of Bill Daltrey from the King of the Hill. No King of the Hill fans here.
What are you talking about? But who's?
Never mind. It's a character from the TV show King of the Hill. He's from Louisiana.
Who are you saying?
And he has a thick Louisiana accent.
Oh, I didn't really pick up on any Louisiana accent from this dude. I thought the dude playing Blob sounded more Southern than the dude playing.
He tried to sound Louisiana.
I know he was trying, Cajun. But it didn't sound. He tried to sound Cajun to me.
The thing is, he was the guy from Friday Night Lights, and I think he was still doing a Texan accent while playing Gambit.
Maybe. Anyway, you find out that Wolverine's girlfriend was never killed. She's actually Silver Fox. She was working for Stryker too.
Shit, that's who she was.
Yeah. So Stryker's got her sister captive, and that's why she's having to work for him. She actually loved Wolverine.
Specifically, her sister is the White Queen.
Is White Queen? Yeah. What do you call it? Then there's fighty, smashy, and
Sabretooth team up to take on Deadpool.
But he's not really Deadpool. He's just some stupid piece of bullshit. He's more of like a Rob Liefeld character from the 90s than probably Deadpool.
Minus the pockets.
This is what Deadpool probably would have become if Rob Liefeld had continued writing. So just the worst, dude, where he's like shooting. He's got, so since Cyclops was captured, he's got the Ruby Quartz eye blaster or whatever. Not the Ruby Quartz.
No, you're talking about Cyclops.
But so that's why I said Cyclops. So he's shooting eye blasts and his swords are in his body now. So he looks like Baraka from Mortal Kombat 2. even with his jacked up, sewn up mouth. And Stryker had made a comment in the very beginning of the movie where he was like, I like y'all better if you didn't have a mouth or something dumb like that. And now they sewed his mouth up. Wah. Just terrible, dude. Oh, and then he's doing Will I Am's power was that he could
teleport,
Bamf everywhere. So he's teleporting everywhere. It's just really, and they're on top of some nuclear coolant towers that are
like 3 Mile Island.
12 inches thick. It's like 12 inches thick, but they're dancing around. It was really, really bad. So then they kill. kill Deadpool, you think? They cut his head off.
That was kind of cool when his head's spinning around and you see the lasers cutting through the tower in that motion.
Yeah, I guess.
I thought that was kind of neat.
Sure, fine. And that caves the whole thing in. Then it ends with, what do you call it? Silver Fox puts her hand on, what's his Stryker. Name? Stryker's leg and says, walk till your feet bleed and walk some more. And that's her power. She influences. So he just like walks forever and she dies. And in the meantime, there's an adamantium gun, which is the only way to quote-unquote kill him. And then he even says in the movie, which I was like, this is the dumbest shit ever. He says, the adamantium bullets won't kill him, but it'll wipe his memory. And at this point, I look over my wife who watched and was like, oh, this is why he loses his memory. So he walks up and he caps him twice in the freaking brain housing. I guess the bullet ricochets in his head and that's how he loses his memory. He wakes up, he's like, I don't know who I am. Where am I? It's terrible. And look, are we talking about the movie or not? I know we're just wrapping
up. You know what? This explains the final season of Game of Thrones now.
That's the whole movie. And I can say, for the first half of this movie, I didn't think it was that bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Given its reputation.
Yeah, especially like all I could remember watching this movie was the trailer and how bad it was when he gets like launched off the helicopter and he's like flying through the air. And I'm like, this movie looks like shit. Watching the movie, that scene actually wasn't that bad. I was kind of surprised when it started. I'm like, oh, here we go, here comes the bad wire work and bad CGI, and it wasn't that bad. But it's really when Gambit shows up and he's flipping the cards around and that looks terrible and there's really bad wire work.
Well, some of the jokes, dude, I hated the one where he sits on the motorcycle and the suspension drops and he goes, wow, you gained some weight there, and he's like, recently, and I'm like,
I mean that whole sequence, because that's when he's testing out the new metal claws that look terrible, awful CGI. And he's meeting like Ma and Pa Kent. It's supposed to be the Hudsons, and like this random naked guy who shows up on their farm. They're like giving him all their son's shit and like, come ride on my motorcycle, and then they immediately get fucking executed just to make Wolverine mad so he can go kill Agent Zero and shit. It's like, this is just, you know, bad writing, like introduction to bad writing. This is how you don't do writing.
I won't lie, for a minute there I thought David Goyer was gonna be one of the writers.
I will say though, dude, when the old lady gets completely yeeted, as the kids say, when she gets sniped through the chest, I you could tell something bad was gonna happen to these old people, but not then. It was like so soon. I'm like, holy shit, they just assassinated two senior citizens on TV. Like extremely graphic. I was like, okay, well maybe this movie's not gonna be so bad. Little did I know.
The ending, dude.
The ending is it's just all so bad. Oh, and then there's the scene where he's fighting Gambit and Gambit's on the fire escape, so Wolverine's like chopping the fire escape.
The super speed chopping.
Like, dude, this is so horrible. Like, why are you doing this?
They didn't
this
even do Gambit's powers right, did they?
Not really.
Who cares?
He like charged them up and he hits you with them. Yeah, compared like to like them exploding and shit.
They kind of works that way a little bit, but none of the pizzazz, none of the character, the charm, the charisma.
Yeah.
It's just that he's a guy with a stick who does some concussion blasts.
So here's a question for you, X-Men fans. Sabretooth is calling him Jimmy the whole movie.
His name is James.
I know his name's James Logan, right? Or something like that.
Okay, I think this is a good James time to pause else. For a moment. Mr. Fix-It, did you ever read Origin, the 2001 miniseries?
So, yes, that was the beginning of this movie.
Right, so go ahead and educate Mac about, you know, what that whole deal was.
That was Quesada, right, or not?
Quesada only did the covers. The writing was by Paul Jenkins and the art was by one of the Kubert boys.
Basically, Wolverine is... I mean, it is the beginning of the movie. Wolverine pops out his claws. He's a sickly kid, and I guess that's when his mutant power kicks in.
Well, they did a thing in the miniseries where they had this guy named Dog, who father looks exactly like Wolverine.
It turns out to be Sabretooth, right?
Well, hold on. So Dog looks like a young Logan. His dad looks like Logan, period. And then you have this other kid named James Howlett, who is a little rich boy, and he's sick all the time, and he's, you know, kind of a milksop. And then there's this Irish girl with reddish hair that, you know, is like a servant girl, and Dog, you know, wants to molest her essentially, and James has to try to put a stop to it, and that causes all this tension. And the assumption at the beginning of the miniseries is that Dog is Wolverine, and then when a Dog's dad comes and accidentally kills James's dad, and then James pops the claws and kills Dog's dad, and then you realize, okay, so James, the little sickly kid, is the one who's going to grow up to be Wolverine. And I thought one of the best things about the miniseries, not that I enjoyed that aspect, but what I thought was clever was Paul Jenkins does the whole Stan Lee thing where the person who's sickly all the time and kind of a wimp is the one whose powers are a manifestation of what he wants to be, a strong, tough guy. And so that happens. And then Dog in the miniseries is got, everybody thinks he's going to grow up to be Sabretooth, but it turns out, no, he's a whole other guy who's got scars across his face when James Howlett slashes his face. And then later on in the series, he's the one who's sent by, you know, James's grandfather to try to track him down. Instead, he's trying to kill him, and the redheaded girl dies, and that's why Wolverine has always had this thing for the redheaded girls. And it's a little bit of an expectation thwarter, because Dog doesn't end up being anything, and yet somehow he ends up being alive in the 20th century eventually. So you can see where a lot of the early part of the movie is drawn from origin, but they also do a bunch of other stuff too, in particular all the shit with Sabretooth being his brother and them spending hundreds of years together, where Wolverine's fine with this guy being, you know, a killer, and then he finally gets a little too psycho hundreds of years into the relationship, and that's when he wants to bust up the team.
All right. I remember a lot of that. I remember the Dog part. I remember James.
It's been a while since I've read that stuff.
I just thought that him calling him Jimmy the whole movie was whack.
Mm-hmm.
Did they do a sequel to that too? Origins?
They did. Kieron Gillen and I think the other Kubert brother did it, and I scanned through that one. It was weird because, like, they find Wolverine in the wilderness where he went feral again after the redheaded girl was killed, and they capture him, and they've got him in a circus, and they electrocute him to make him pop his claws, and there's this girl with a fucked up face who's trying to get him out of the circus, and then her brother appears to be Sabretooth, and the story plays out, and it turns out that they're both Creeds, they're both siblings, and that she has a healing factor too, but they were testing acid on her face one time and it stuck because she left it on for too long. And so the guy you think is Sabretooth is actually like Sabretooth's younger brother, and Wolverine kills that guy, and then it pisses off the real Sabretooth, who starts visiting him on his birthday to basically mistreat him the way he'd mistreated his younger brother. Bad. And then they never resolve what happened to Sabretooth's sister, and they're playing around with stuff from Wolverine number 10, which was the last issue that Claremont wrote of the original run, and that's where they were picking up from a thread that they had in Classic X-Men, where Sabretooth visits Wolverine on his birthday every year and tries to kill him or just, you know, do horrible stuff. And that's where they introduce the idea of him having this Native American or Native Canadian, Indigenous Canadian love, Silver Fox, who Sabretooth is supposed to kill. But then later on in the comics, it turned out she's alive in the Larry Hama run, which is one of those things, again, that drove me nuts with Hama, is that even Silver Fox couldn't stay dead. And by the way, played by Lynn Collins, who also infamously played not her race in Prince of Egypt. She's a Houstonian, by the way. So they're drawing from a lot of comic books here. And when Gavin Hood was announced, there was a sense that we were going to have a serious director and we're going to get back to the meat and potatoes X-Men stuff. And then when it all goes off the rails and you have all the silly shit, like the fight with Blob and stuff and the fat suit and all that kind of shit, the fact that you've got Ryan Reynolds and he's only in one scene and he's doing bullets and bracelets with the fucking swords, where it's just going, taking it way too far and too goofy. And just all this excesses, these superhero movie excesses, and you know Laura Shuler Donner and in this case Richard Donner involved with it. So when Wolverine's chopping down that fire escape, that's straight out of the Superman movies, that kind of level of goofy comedy and badly executed action, and you know, in this case they had a lot of bad CGI, and so it ended up being much goofier than everybody expected, especially that last half of the movie, and it really turned a lot of people off, even though it made okay money. But it's funny because they were clearly trying and they were drawing from a lot of comic book material. They didn't have faith in it because everybody's running around in plain clothes, and they did take liberties with the characters that didn't pan out, and this movie gets a really bad backlash. I think it's better than its reputation, but it's not good at all.
Yeah,
I will say though, I like Liev Schreiber, is that his name?
Yeah, Liev, he was a pretty good Sabretooth. Yeah,
I thought he was pretty damn good. Like that's what I'm saying. I like, even when Will I Am popped up in the credits, I'm like, this movie's gonna fucking suck. And then you're like, I didn't think he wasn't that bad in that movie. Nah, and you guys are kind of shitting on the Blob. I mean, he's fine. He didn't really have a big part in it. And then the dude, he was Blob was fine too. Like, I didn't have any problem. Blob's a doofus, horrible. Like, how is that character going to translate anyway, right? So that's all fine. I thought it was funny where they were like, don't make fat jokes to him, whatever. Or no, he said something like,
don't talk about his weight.
He got depressed. Yeah, don't talk about his weight. He got depressed and just found his coping mechanism like everybody else. Like, yeah, that kind of stuff. I thought that was kind of funny. Like, I thought this movie had some. it just potential. Falls so hard off the rails in the back half of the movie. Yeah. So anyway, that's my first non X-Men movie in this universe, and it was not great. It was like, oh no, this is why I don't watch these movies. Like these are not good. This movie came out a year after Iron Man, I compare all of this stuff to when Iron Man came out. If you're not if like the effects are not even close to Iron Man a year later, I'm pointing it out. I'm sorry. Those claws looked horrible. Mm-hmm. They were terrible, dude. The whole end fight scene on 3 Mile Island was terrible. All that CGI stuff was terrible. Just no excuse. And then, like Mr. Fix It brought, I didn't do it in my recap, but where Professor X shows up and Cyclops was there, and it's like you're trying to build your universe, except you just ignored all this stuff. Like it's like as opposite of the Marvel universe as the DC stuff, where they're just screwing up their own continuity left and right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, literally, they're rewriting maybe first drafting elements of the movie in Hollywood while it's still being filmed in Australia and like phoning them the changes and shit. And I think that's part of why you have this collection of scenes, but not really a sense of a story, like an overarching movie, really, you know, it just seems like it's a collection of sequences more than a movie that holds together as a single unit.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's a shit show. And again, I guess I didn't understand why, because everybody hates this movie because they all love Deadpool, and this movie is so bad to Deadpool, right? Mm-hmm. It's almost like we know you all love Deadpool, so we're going to make him the worst character, like we're going to shit on his corpse. Like that's everybody's going to this movie because you heard Ryan Reynolds is going to be Deadpool, and we're going to just like, you know, have sex with the corpse, you know? It's awful. Like this is a terrible treatment of this character. And after watching the beginning part, I'm like, wait, he's got lines in this movie? I thought like he didn't even talk in this whole movie. I'm like, and he's being funny. Like he's being Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool. Like this is fine to me. Why is everybody so, this must be like fanboy complaints. And then it just spirals out and I was like, oh yeah, this is horrible. Like this is the blob monster at the end of Blade. It's all a Goyer, right? Mm-hmm. It's all that, it's that stuff, right? It turns into a Goyer movie, like Mr. Fix-It said, where it's like, no, this is all the worst parts of superhero movies. You had it kind of going there in the beginning when they kill Silver Fox, his girlfriend. I was like, damn, like I knew she didn't survive to later movies, but I didn't think they were gonna, you know, do that. And then they okie-doked me later on with her coming back, and I'm like, okay, that, like, this kind of works, this is okay. But the movie itself, like I said, it's maybe not as bad as I thought it was gonna be, but it was not good.
Yeah. And then 2 years later they do X-Men First Class, and for a lot of people that was a real course correction, and that helped out a lot, as far as feeling like maybe they were gonna get back on track. And then 4 years, I believe, 9, 10, 11, 12, yeah, 4 years from this movie, you have The Wolverine, released July 26, 2013. This one's directed by James Mangold, and this guy is like an actual, serious, real director. Copland, Girl Interrupted, Walk the Line. He had most recently done Night and Day, the not-successful Tom Cruise, Cameron Diaz vehicle, but like a real movie director. And prior to James Mangold taking it over, they were going to have Darren Aronofsky do the movie. He ended up dropping out because he didn't want to spend a year of his life working on a superhero movie. They're working off of the core story written by Christopher McQuarrie of Usual Suspects, and in more recent years he's one of the writer and directors of the Mission Impossible movies people really like. Rewrites were done by Mark Baumbach, who had done a Die Hard and the Total Recall remake. But while his filmography wasn't great going into The Wolverine, he's the guy who wrote both of the Planet of the Apes reboot mini sequels, and I think most people like those pretty well. There was also writing from Scott Frank. This is a guy who wrote Get Shorty, Out of Sight, Minority Report. After this he's going to do Logan, and most recently he's been working on Queen's Gambit. So these are some serious people. The movie is budgeted somewhere between $100 and $132 million. It made $414 million, so closer to that quadruple that they used to be able to get from the X-Men movies. And a lot of comic book influences here, but much more narrow cast than X-Men Origins. Hugh Jackman was on the record of saying that the original 1982 Wolverine miniseries was his favorite Wolverine story, and the core narrative in this movie is that four-issue miniseries, Chris Claremont and Frank Miller, set in Japan, where Wolverine is meeting back up with Mariko, who he had already been introduced to during the John Byrne run of X-Men in 79, and she's got dealings with, like, Yakuza, and so he's having to fight hand ninjas. You know, it's credited to Frank Miller, and you have that very cinematic quality that Frank Miller brings to his work, but he's being inked by Joseph Rubinstein, so you have this really strong, like, Neil Adamsy vibe, and a much more action movie vibe than, you know, might have had otherwise. but also they're adapting the two-issue arc from Uncanny X-Men number 172 through 173 that Paul Smith did, where Wolverine was actually going to marry Mariko and had invited the X-Men to Japan for that wedding. And that's when the Viper is brought into it, the Viper from Hydra, the former Lady Hydra. That's when the Silver Samurai is brought in. I don't think he was introduced there. I think that was one of his earlier appearances, though. And in particular, you have the extended silent fight sequence between Wolverine and the Silver Samurai. That's one of the best fight sequences ever put to page.
Yep, awesome.
Gorgeous. And, you know, Paul Smith is just such a glorious artist anyway and has done so little work. And he does such a great job of showing Japan and showing how the characters are displaced. You also have the character of Yukio, who is looks a lot like actually Black Widow, but obviously Japanese and with black hair. And she's this kind of wild child who'd appeared in the Wolverine miniseries and had helped them against the Yakuza. And she brings Stormwatch into her circle and shows her this wilder side of life. And Storm had been struggling with how she had changed after coming from Africa to the United States and being a member of the X-Men. And because of her time with Yukio, that's when she decides to go punk and shave her head with a mohawk. She had just recently killed, or thought she had killed Callisto and won the command of the Morlocks. And so all those changes she was going through were manifested through wearing black leather and spikes and everything else. So those two issues are pretty important. And earlier on, Fixit was talking about Wolverine and Rogue teaming up. Rogue had just joined the X-Men, and because of circumstances, it ends up being Wolverine and Rogue going up against the enemy forces. And so that was sort of a proving ground for that character. So some of my favorite X-Men stories there in the case of the Uncanny X-Men. Now, with the Wolverine miniseries, when I pulled out of that quarter band, I was really disappointed at it, because to me, I felt like it was sort of a boilerplate, you know, he's in Japan, he's fighting people. You know, it didn't really do much for me, but they did a good job of adapting it to film, and it's pretty faithful to that story arc, including featuring the characters. Now, Mr. Fixit, you've seen the Wolverine, right?
Yes.
Can you give us a short version of what happens in that movie?
We're introduced to Wolverine. I'm assuming it's World War II. He's captured in Japan.
Put a metal plate over a well, and they've trapped him in this well.
They're dropping one of the A-bombs. One of the soldiers decides to go free him. Falls down the hole. Wolverine uses his body to shield the guy. The guy survives. We're now introduced to Wolverine present time. He's living out in the woods.
I think it's important to note that this is taking place. This is the first movie to take place after The Last Stand. And so he is. It's interesting because we talked about how in X2, Wolverine, from X2 to Final Stand, Wolverine's kind of cavalier about the death of Jean Grey, and he's kind of like telling Scott to get over it. But then at the end of The Last Stand, he's the one who has to gut Jean Grey with his knives and kill her, and whatever macho posturing he was able to bring up in Last Stand is gone. He loses his shit. He goes off to the Canadian wilderness. He grows like hobo beard, and he's like, you know, getting into fights with bears and shit.
No, he's actually protecting the bear.
Well, the bear got hit with a poison arrow and went nuts, and so Wolverine had to
by some asshole hunter who's using like illegal poison tipped arrows, so the bear goes nuts and Wolverine has to, you know, put it out of his misery. And that's when I can't remember the name of the character who was introduced, the samurai.
You're talking about the girl who's helping Wolverine?
The Japanese girl, yeah.
So that's Yukio. She's played by Rilla Fukushima. She would go on to play Katana on the Arrow TV show, and she does the voice for Sumi on the Castlevania cartoon. I think she's got a really interesting face, a really unique face that makes her stand out. She has the pink hair with a sort of a, I don't know what you call that haircut, but it's just like almost like a bowl kind of thing. I wasn't in love with the hair, but I thought the actress did a nice job of playing that character. Maybe a little more emotional, a little younger than she would have been relative to how she was portrayed in the comics, but I liked her attitude, and I thought she worked really well with Wolverine.
Well, she's there to retrieve Wolverine because it turns out the soldier he rescued in Japan in World War II is now some big tech billionaire and wants to help Wolverine because Wolverine is suffering, or he's no
Wolverine. Lord Shinjin.
Oh, he wants to die.
Yeah, Lord Shinjin, who is in the comics, he was the father of Mariko. Now, because of the passage of time, he's the grandfather. He believes that Wolverine is so emotionally broken that he's ready to die, and so he invites Wolverine to Japan because he's with his scientists have come up with a process where he could get the healing factor away from Wolverine and put it into himself, and that Wolverine could live a normal life and die and not be tormented by a seeming eternity of life.
Yeah, and turns out, Was that the initial? They were going to kill him because Wolverine wanted to die and he was going to take his powers? Because I kind of got confused with the whole Silver Samurai and all that bullshit.
Yeah, that's toward the end of the movie, though. We'll touch on that.
Yeah.
But right now, the pages that Shinjin is offering that to Wolverine. Wolverine declines. And then later that same night, Shinjin dies. And then that starts this whole family drama.
Right, that's right. It's been like 2 days since I've seen his movie, so yeah. I'm trying to remember.
So what is the family drama, though?
The daughter takes on the mantle of power, doesn't she?
What it is the will is going to be read in 3 days. And her father knows that Shinjin has given the company over to his daughter, Shinjin's granddaughter. Mariko Yoshida is played by Dao Akimoto. She played Mercy Graves in Batman vs. Superman. And as my girlfriend noted while we were watching it, she was super, super, super skinny. So kind of her defining characteristic is how real thin she is. And I remember her being real thin in BVS as well. And so she's going to take over the Yoshida Corporation, the largest corporation in Japan, once the will is read. But her own father is so hungry for the company that he's willing to put his daughter's life in danger to take control from her before she, you know, becomes the head of it. And there's also government forces and Yakuza who are trying to basically off her so that they can deal with the son, Brian, who's played by Brian T, by the way. No, that's someone. Hold on. Who's he? Where's he at? I don't know. He don't really give a shit. Who'd rather deal with her father than her because she has morals and he's a bit of a scumbag, it seems like.
Okay. And then we get the summer. Turns out Wolverine is dying because he has some kind of nano machine in him that's nullifying his healing capability.
Yeah, the same scientist that was going to be able to take his powers from him neutralizes powers. This is Viper, played by Svetlana Kodchinkova. And there was supposed to be, Jessica Biel was apparently going to play the role. And then when negotiations broke down, so they got this Russian actress, who I guess maybe is some kind of hot shit. I hated her portrayal of that character. I never felt like she had a good handle on it. And the whole thing with making her a scientist was also irritating for me as a comic book fan.
Okay. Silver Samurai shows up. Wolverine fights. It turns out it's the old guy in the suit of armor. They cut off one of his claws. I don't remember the ending no more.
So what's happening, what we will ultimately find out is Mariko has a fiance named Noboru. He's played by Brian T, who people will probably remember as playing Liu Kang, Shredder, and he was DK in Tokyo Drift. He's supposed to be this big-time prosecutor. He's supposed to be going after the mob, but it's mostly all for show. He's definitely totally corrupt. And what he explains is the plan is, you know, let's go ahead and kill off Mariko and, you know, I'll get my guy in there instead. Once everybody ends up back in the Silver Samurai's base, and Silver Samurai in this version is a giant android, like a robot, it seems like, or an armored suit. And the plan is actually that my impression was that he was either going to transfer his consciousness into Mariko or he was going to take the healing factor from Wolverine. And I don't know why Mariko was involved then. It's a really convoluted plan when you factor that in. But apparently the Silver Samurai has a sword that can become so superheated they can cut through the adamantium. And he's drawing all the adamantium into his armor so that he can be greater fortified. He has also developed a means to basically bore into Wolverine's bones and start not only extracting the adamantium from the bones, but also extracting his healing abilities. And since the samurai turns out to be the guy from the 1940s that Wolverine had saved, he is wanting to restore his vitality and gain the healing factor of Wolverine, ideally live forever. But after he had cut Wolverine's adamantium claws off, Mariko, you know, angry because she had been underestimated this whole time and manipulated this whole time, she gets the claw, she stabs her grandfather in the head with one of the claws. Wolverine manages to finish him off, and then he regains his healing factor. And I think he cuts off the guy. Oh yeah, and at the very end, he pops his bone claws, and so we're back on this bullshit, unfortunately.
Yeah,
and I forgot to mention too, the Viper Mac, as I recall correctly, didn't one of your sons really take the Viper after picking up one of the Captain America comics out of a chibi bin?
Yeah, I got the issue. It's a Zek issue where Viper has Cap and Nomad slash Bucky drugged, and the Constrictor's there, and they're going to be in some, they're in some parade, and even Constrictor's like, this plan is so jacked up, even he doesn't, like, can't be down with it, and he's like trying to get Cap to wake up the whole time. So she's the bad guy in that one, and they couldn't understand why. If Constrictor's a bad guy, why is he helping Captain America? And I was like, well, you know, it's sometimes even bad guys have their limits, you know. But yeah, so they were all about Viper. And then we watched the Earth's Mightiest Heroes Avengers cartoon, and Viper's in that too. So
yeah. So in this one, she's a doctor called Mrs. Green, Dr. Green. And she also has a snake tongue, and she spits venom at people. And she at one point sheds her skin. She's a blonde, but when she eventually takes off her wig to show that she's actually bald. And the actress just vamps the entire time. In no way does she have that intensity that you'd expect from Viper. I always picture Viper being like a Linda Fiorentino type, and this lady just couldn't pull that off at all. And ultimately, I think she gets choked to death by Yukio. Just bad stuff. Also, throughout the movie, you've got Famke Janssen playing Jean Grey, and she's constantly trying to lure Logan into dying and joining her. And at the very end of the movie, he's like, I'm not ready to die. I'm not ready to die for you. I'm sorry that I killed you, but you were hurting people and I had to stop you. And you can kind of go off, you know, I'm not going to be seeing you again anytime soon. But they did a really nice job with having her appear throughout the movie. Not only was it nice to see her play that character, but it gave it a real horror edge. And she had a sense of menace, and it really seemed to play out the consequences of Last Stand in a way that you didn't see in the movie itself. So the movie, for the most part overall, I think is pretty good. It's too long. I was checking my watch the whole time I was watching it. It just seems like it's a little too drawn out. They do have the stinger at the end where Magneto is back, and he's trying to recruit Wolverine to help them save Space-Time Continuum, I guess after the last movie fucked everything up so bad. And they've also revealed that Professor X has transplanted his consciousness into his brother's body on Muir Island, and is basically, you know, back same as he ever was, and they're all going to team up to do Days of Future Past. And like I said, I thought the movie was good. It was definitely one of the better of the X-Men movies, and certainly among the better Wolverine movies. But I do think it was really long, and most people agree that that last third, where they've got the robot armors and everything else, it just gets too comic booky and it loses that grounded quality. But it's hard not to notice James Mangold is so much better at directing action, and that you know, people actually physically seem to inhabit their spaces, and it doesn't look like a green screen nightmare. But one thing that does bug me about both the Wolverine movies is it's clear that the directors are still trying to direct in that Bryan Singer lane. It's like they both of these movies look like Bryan Singer productions, and I think that we benefit from getting away from the Singer vision once you move on to Logan.
Okay.
You didn't see it, so I know you can't elaborate. What did you think about it, Mr. Fixit?
I thought it was okay. I prefer Logan over this over these two, but I mean, it was all right. I don't think I'll ever watch it again.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, I can guarantee you I'll never watch either one of these two again.
Yeah.
I can tell you, it doesn't. The fact that Viper is some sort of snake mutant does not sound cool.
No, very much not.
And I can only imagine the Fox level of CGI means that none of this looked good either.
It definitely looked better than Origins, but not to Marvel caliber, you know. But it was decent. It was fair. Aside from the Silver Samurai, which is definitely CGI nightmare, most of the rest of it looks pretty good.
I guess I gotta watch it now. Now I gotta watch it.
Okay, that's it then, apparently.
So we're never going to talk about that Frank Miller miniseries. Unbelievable, dude.
No, we didn't.
When did we talk about it?
I was talking about it within the context of the movie, because the movie was essentially an adaptation of the miniseries.
But you never asked me what I thought about the miniseries. I told, motherfucker.
Well, come on. You didn't see the movie, so talk about the miniseries.
Nah, I'm all pissed off. But I didn't realize that that movie was based off the miniseries. Otherwise, I would have skipped the shit movie and watched this movie, because I owned that four-part miniseries, and it was one of the first series of comic books I collected that was like, this is actually might be worth money someday. And I kept, dude, I'm telling you, I had the most fucking uber mint copies of that miniseries. I don't know how I got them. I can't remember how I got them. And I know I didn't pay a lot for them, because this would have been like 90 or 89, 1990 or something. I might have got them in Phoenix at some comic book shop in Phoenix. I can't remember. But I'm telling you, dude, there was a different kind of paper stock. Weren't they kind of like the Marvel Saga paper stock or not?
Nope, plain newsprint.
Dude, I'm telling you, I had the most crisp white pages on the borders of these things you have ever seen in your whole lives. Like, outrageous. So I kept them in the, you know, you had the bagging board and then you had like the stiff
Mylar
plastic that they would go into. I kept those in those and they were like my prized. I only took them, I think I read them once and I never took them out of those things because even back then I realized these are in such, because these are the best conditioned comic books I will probably own in my entire life. And I kept them like that. And then they were lost in horrible times. But yeah, dude, I owned the freaking Frank Miller, John Buscema. It was John, right? It was Big John, right?
Frank Miller. No, you talking about the inker?
Yeah.
Joseph Rubenstein.
It was Rubenstein? Wait, mm-hmm. who wrote those?
Chris Claremont.
So Chris Claremont wrote, Frank Miller drew them?
Mm-hmm.
Who drew number one?
Frank Miller with Joseph Rubenstein. Yeah. The thing is Joe Rubenstein is another assimilator along the lines of a Bob Layton. And so it doesn't look like Miller because Rubenstein really, you know, I think they give Frank Miller full credit as the artist, but I think it was more of like a layout kind of thing with Rubenstein doing finishes because the finished product looks like Rubenstein, but it has that cinematic flow you expect from Miller and also the ninjas you expect from Miller.
When did John Buscema do, did he take over?
He did the Marvel Comics Presents, the first run of stories in Marvel Comics Presents, and he's the one who started the Wolverine ongoing series.
Okay, maybe that's what I'm thinking. Maybe I'm just thinking Buscema because he took over after that series was over. Because, right, didn't the miniseries basically preclude the ongoing series?
No, there's like a 6-year gap between the two of them.
That was, for me, it wouldn't have been 6 years because that would have been after I started comics. So.
Well, if you're talking about, I bought a book with Wolverine as the title, and then I bought another book with Wolverine as the title, then yeah, one was right after the other.
Okay, and Buscema did the cover to that one where he's standing on the pile of dudes with a patch on his
back? Yep.
Okay, I'm just getting slight confusion there. I apologize. But yes, so I had that original miniseries, and those were some of the first Wolverine comic books I ever read. That stuff and the Sam Keith Marvel Comics Presents stuff, that was my Wolverine, which is totally different than most other people's Wolverine, but that was the Wolverine stuff. I read like the non-popular X-Men stuff. The stuff that was so not liked, he didn't get an ongoing series for 6 more years.
Well, no, actually the Wolverine miniseries was a huge success. I think it was more that Chris Claremont was trying to retain control of the character and wanted to keep that as the added value character in the X-Men. It's kind of like how Marv Wolfman wouldn't let Nightwing go and have a solo book because he wanted him to be one of the draws for New Teen Titans, to the detriment of the character in the case of Nightwing, where I think with Wolverine, it probably helped Wolverine to wait a little longer and build up a little bit more lore before he tried to get in his own ongoing series and still struggled a bit in those first few years.
Anyway, that was it. You put that in front of you talking about the Wolverine movie.
Okay.
Is this going to be a 2-part podcast?
I don't know yet. The recording is 2 hours and 40 minutes, so I'm not sure, but I don't think that the movie stuff holds up on its own, so I think it's going to just have to be a long ass, plus there's a lot of tangents in there. We're talking about arcades and shit, so I think if I cut that stuff out and set off to the side, we ought to be okay. I don't know if I'm going to have it ready for Wednesday, but I'm going
to
try.
I was going to say, if you wanted to just do one more, we can all record later this week on just Logan, and you add Logan to the movie stuff, and you can do a part one Logan. Comics part.
We did a podcast on Logan.
Oh yeah, we did. We actually did a podcast on Logan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. That makes sense. We've been doing this a long time.
Yeah, no, right?
Holy shit.
Well, when you get to the point where you've forgotten which ones you've recorded on, you've been doing it a while. All
right, man.
Yeah, it's late. And I think I thought you might have actually passed out on us. I was waiting to hear her snoring.
All right, guys. Have a good night.
Love you.
All
talk right, to you later.
Later.
Permanent Marvelite Maximus followers include Colorful Sisters, Comic Book Historians, Cuisine Wanderlust, Dave's Comic Heroes Blog, Easy Street Designs, Stickers and Comics, Elaine Barber, Feast Wanderlust, Grub Cooking, Leek Costa, and MB. Fearless Facebook front facers include DeBache, Derek William Crabb, and Michael Wagner. Thanks for the shout-outs from Canoes, Dirk Ashton, and Brian Dockery. Retweet frantic ones include CH, King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun Podcast, and Talk Nerdy to Me. Keepers of the Favorites Flame include 82017, Al Hodge, Austin Kirkendall, Casey Lau, Chris Dunford, Dragon Prime, Edward Huey, Fanholes Podcast, Francis, Friends Talking Fantasy Podcast, Froomgar Nebraskan, Harmless Entertainment, Jason Rogar, Jennifer DeRoss, John is Watching Cartoons, Keith G. Baker, King Dinosaur, Michaela Elaine, The Master of the Galaxy, Max Damage, Mike It's an Alias to Me, Quidanoon, Pierre DeVilbis, Richard Field, Stimbot 5000, and Oofda. Among the
enough sayers on our WandaVision episode. Richard G. said, not only do we march on, we hero on. Love being included in these things. DeBay said, saving this one for my drive over the weekend. One day I hope to meet all of you in person. I suspect Frank is just as much a force of nature as he is on the podcast. I'm definitely not going to oversell myself. I'm actually an extremely boring person. But hopefully one of these days we can do one of these fire and water get-togethers, and you can join in on one of those. So look forward to seeing if it does happen. Michael Wagner wrote, Frank be like, and then he added the evil grinning girl in a house fire gif. Sitcoms are for when you want to tune out and look at your screen and be mildly amused when the writing is funny. Canoes write, looking forward to this one. Rant around the 40-minute mark had me in tears of laughter. Happy to serve. Reverend Odell Dracula wrote, not too spicy though, right? And then posts the Adventure Time so spicy gif. Don't you guys know you can mute things on Twitter? I didn't see any of that fan junk you mentioned. With Frank so PO'd about his 90 minutes, I guess you won't be covering HBO Max's four-hour slow-mo objectivist bonanza. Please don't mention it by name at Summons Parademons. Yeah, notice I know he's talking about that shit anymore. Anyway, I like the show more than any of you, but I did let myself believe she, very disappointing, spoiler alert, either yoinked her brother from the multiverse or, even better, created the whole Fox continuity of X-Men movies on a whim and then ported him over from there. Hey, Reverend, there's always headcanon. Ryan Daly wrote, fix it. Can you summarize House of M for the listeners? Why, Frank? Why would you ask him to do that? I had to stop 2 minutes into his sitcoms with the lowest form of entertainment rant, and I have to specify, I said something like narrative storytelling. You know, basically sitcoms just reset over and over again, and everything's very familiar, and so there's not a lot of world building, there's not a lot of continuity. You know, it's not that I have anything against sitcoms. I enjoy sitcoms. WandaVision won a sitcom because it wasn't fucking funny. Kyle Benning wrote, how many times did Frank say basic in his rant? I'm essentially co-signing on all of Illegal Machines' takes. As with all of these shows, I managed to completely avoid spoilers and not watch them as they're dropping so I can binge them later and keep it fresh. Binged all 9 episodes the last 2 days. Really enjoyed it more than I thought I would. And finally, Jeffrey Brown wrote, so I watched all of WandaVision, and I have to say, I was surprised with all of the twists and turns. I liked how they crafted the story in a way for us, the viewer, to follow Wanda and her grief since losing Vision by the hand of Thanos during Infinity War and coming back after the snap. I also like how Agatha Harkness was brought into the story first as a supporting character, aka the nosy neighbor, and how her true nature and backstory were revealed in a way that homaged her origin from the comics while doing something new, and I thought making her a bad witch.
Stan Lee presents the Merry Marching Society of the Marvel Superhero Podcast.
1/8 Sage, Dr. Ange, Bay Skeletor, Brian Dockery, Canoes, Chris Lydon, Dave's Comic Heroes Blog, Doc Strange, Dirk Ashton, Firestorm Fan, Green Lantern HG, The Hammer Strikes, Geeky Stuff and Voiceover, History of Comics on Film, Hulkling, Hashtag Black Lives Matter, I Was Joe Crawford, Jason Stick Venable, this is our sneakiest episode yet, so I hope you enjoy it. Jeffrey Brown, They Them, Jenna Reagan, Jin, Marvel Universe Online, Randy Caldwell, Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Reverend Odell Abner Dracula, Richard G, Ryan Daly, Sophia, Tim Price Podcrasher, Tony Scipione, Tora, Trans Lesbian Planet Eater, Wacky Bronze Silver Comic Book Villains, and Zwick Jameson.
This has been a non-for-profit fan production from Rolled Spine Podcast. Any copyrighted material presented herein are presumed covered under fair use, with no infringement intended. Till next time, Excelsior!